that we reconsider the vote on which we Senate B3158A to the floor and pass recommendations. The purpose is of bringing the bill back before the committee to accept the clarifying amendment. Is there objection? And so ordered. We now have House Bill 3158A in front of us, and we have a amendment proposed by the Oregon Youth Authority. Mr.
Chairman, members of the committee, this amendment would basically allow or require that a parole or probation officer be notified that the youth offender was not attending school. And it's something we talked about in the hearing, and the committee seems favorably disposed, but for some reason during a work session that was overlooked. So we brought the bill back to the course and should be added.
And this makes sense to the other bills, Senator Courtney and I have supported, where we're trying to facilitate the exchange of information.
So, we're in work session?
We are in work session.
I move the dash to amendments to House Bill 3158.
Senator Courtney moves the dash to amendments to House Bill 3158. Is there discussion? Objection? Carried.
I move House Bill 3158 as amended before the due pass recommendation.
The motion is to send the bill as amended to the floor with the due pass recommendation. Discussion? Objection? We will now open a public hearing on HBR 11 and invite Ed Patterson.
Yes.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, I am Ed Patterson. Excuse me, I'm representing myself here today. HBR 11 is a House resolution commemorating former Representative Gordon L. McPherson. And if you'll see the resolution in front of you, which I presume, you'll see that Gordon was an outstanding legislator. He served three terms. I was chair of the House Committee on Judiciary in one term. Was a co-sponsor of Oregon's landmark bottle bill during his tenure. Was instrumental in drafting and passing Oregon's beach bill. And a law creating the Oregon Dunes Recreation Area. He served as professional president of the Lincoln County Bar Association. And as a personal friend of his, I can tell you that he did have a sharp wit and a sharp mind and a great sense of humor. Gordon was an outstanding legislator in just three terms. I first met Gordon in the 1971 session, which was my first session as a member of the House, and his second session as a member of the House. At that time, just to put in context, Governor Tom McCall was then governor. Bob Smith was Speaker of the House. I'm trying to think who the Senate President was at that time. His mind escapes me, But that was the context, and Gordon and I hit it off as friends right off the bat. He went on to serve as the minority leader in his third term in 73. I was privileged to serve on his leadership team. Myself, Norma Paulus, Bob Stoltz went on to be a judge in Douglas County, and Norma, of course, everybody knows, and was a privilege to serve with him. Gordon and I developed a deep and lasting friendship. I think those of you who have served in the legislative body recognize that sometimes that does occur, and it's very unique, I think, to have a relationship that lasts for over 20 years. As a matter of fact, Gordon was my best man at my wedding 20 years ago today. Well, that's kind of a controversy.
Happy anniversary.
Well, thank you very much, Senator. But I want to tell you that I think he was an outstanding legislator, and just to say to the committee that you would honor him and his family greatly and his member's memory greatly if you would adopt this resolution. He was a person that had you could always trust. And for 20 years, I enjoyed his friendship. It would be remiss not to tell you that the last time I saw him was just about 8 days before he died, and went over to visit him and his wife at his home. And he always, in a friendly way, called you boy. And he said, in his few moments of lucidness, said, "Sit down here, boy," not recognizing there was no place for me to sit there in his room. So but he said there's going to be a big family gathering here next week. He's very aware of the situation, and he maintained a sense of humor and the type of a guy he was throughout his 20 years that I knew him and throughout the period of his death. So, Mr. Chair, on behalf of his friends, I would have to ask you to adopt the resolution.
I met him on two occasions.
Did you?
And I enjoyed his sense of humor. I graduated law school in May of 73, and they were advertising for an associate. He had a law office at that time, a young man. And so I went over and interviewed, and he was in lunch money. So he missed the interview, and one of the things his partner complained about, I think there were just the two of them, was how difficult it was to run a law practice for the legislature. And his, one of his hopes was that Gordon wasn't going to run anymore. Of course, he didn't after that session, I think primarily because he supported himself and his family. He
right.
didn't. But then I did meet him over here, and gracious and funny, and they offered me a job. I didn't end up taking it. I went to Bend instead, but they had good judgment. Questions? Thank you. Yeah,
thank you, Mr. Chair. Should be noted, he didn't meet you, right?
Well, he did.
Oh, he did. Well, he did. Quite
nice. I could, you know, appear to be a president of Congress. We'll close the public hearing on HCR 11.
I move HCR 11 for the Chair's recommendation.
Thank you. Senator Courtney moves HCR to the fourth. You have recommendation. Questions? Objections? So ordered. And I'll be happy to carry. Did you know this year's paper?
No, I just met him, but I just know it.
I'll be happy to carry. All right, we'll go into work session on 23E3. Taylor. And Sweet.
Chair, this is the adverse possession bill that the committee heard earlier this month. And the amendments that you have before you, I believe, have been agreed to by all the parties attached to this measure. E3 specify that absent additional supporting facts, the grazing of livestock in and of itself is insufficient to meet the requirements under the adverse possession statute. And those are the -812.
Thank you. Committee, this is one that deals with a court case and raised questions about raising the livestock and whether or not that's sufficient to satisfy the requirements of adverse possession in rural Oregon. It shouldn't be sufficient to do that without other considerations. So the chair then would move the -812 amendments to House Bill 2383. Discussion? Objection? Or the chair then would move HB 2382 to the floor. If it's passed, the recommendation as amended. Discussion? Objection? Or I'll be happy to carry that. Senator Metzger will be here. We will now open a public hearing on House Bill 3489. We'll take public testimony today, but won't go into work session on this today. And I'll invite George Reed.
What is that bill again, sir?
It's 3489. It deals with a case called the Dornovan decision.
Oh, good. Okay.
And this is George Reed, who is from Chief County.
Senator Bryant, members of the committee, thank you for letting me speak here today. There are several others here who probably can explain the breadth of this measure more than I can. However, there is a court case that occurred in Cook County, a neighboring county of Deschutes County, regarding splitting non-farm parcels. It basically said that the parcel had to be at least 80 acres in size or meet the minimum lot size of a farm parcel. Prior to that, most counties, I believe, felt that non-farm parcels were not regulated by the minimum lot size in the statute. That was sort of a shock, and it's kind of changed the minimum lot size throughout the state. We've had quite a go around here in this session talking about the various ramifications of changing what we believe was a simple fix of a court case that was that interpreted the statute. We've had kind of a working group. We've been working on this. There's been a lot of compromise in coming up with what we have. I'd like to point out that this is not something that allows partitioning farmland in its present form. While land is zoned exclusive farm use, the requirements I'd just like to go over that are in here, left in this bill, that kind of limit what land we're talking about. First of all, in its present form, this bill only relates to each of the Cascades. Secondly, I'd like to point out that it only allows parcels that are 40 acres or larger in size to be split. Third, it only allows parcels to be split that are composed of at least 90% Class 6 through 8 soils, 90%. Next, they can't be capable of producing 20 cubic feet commercial tree species per year. Next, they can't support 5 animal units per month. They can't have water rights. And finally, they have to be generally unsuitable for production of farm crops, livestock, merchantable trees, and so on, which actually is the present standard. But I just want to assure you that this bill, in its present form, is pretty restrictive in terms of what you can do. I don't know who else is going to talk. There is Representative Lundquist, I know, has been involved, and I believe Jessica, his staff person, has some other comments, but I'd like to say that in its present form, this is pretty watered down. It allows limited partitions, 2 lots total, 1 new lot for lots less than the minimum lot size, and then leaves the present standard as decided by the court case intact. So with that, I would conclude and ask if there are any questions.
Prior to the Dornovan decision, and to give the committee a little history, and I'm not a land use attorney, but in 1993, he spent a great deal of time carving out, revising some of the land use laws, and in particular dealing with ESUs and forest lands. And I read the Dornovan decision, and then I think interprets what we intended to do in 93 incorrectly. And as a result of that, what counties had been doing for 4 or 5 years after the 93 legislation, suddenly you could no longer do. And as related to minimum lot sizes that you could have after dividing ESU property, that is marginal farm property. And what was Deschutes County doing prior to that time?
Senator Bryant, prior to House Bill 3661, there was a 20-acre minimum lot size. 3661 established an 80-acre minimum lot size or a go-below standard for farm parcels, but we believe was silent on non-farm parcels. So we left it at 20 acres.
And so it left it on non-farm parcels, it left it to the counties, at least that was your interpretation until the Dornovan case, to decide what their lot size would be.
That's correct.
And so Deschutes County left it at, again, what was the standard?
It was a 20-acre minimum lot size.
And Cook County, do you remember what theirs was?
I believe it was, I'm not certain. I'm not certain.
That's the Dornovan case came out of Cook County. So this particular bill does not take us back to the pre-Dornovan case.
Not in my opinion.
I wouldn't mind that.
Senator Bryan, I think what was interesting, and I think we had a lot of people on the working group, I think everybody had a different opinion of what this did. We actually had gone before the LCDC and had acquired a 20-acre minimum lot size for non-farm parcels. We had some testimony from the rules that implemented House Bill 3661 where no one knew exactly what the non-farm minimum lot size was. This will clarify it. And one thing I left out, this says one other thing. It goes beyond all those restrictions that I put on it and says that new lots, in other words, if you have a 200-acre parcel and the 80-acre minimum lot size applies, today you could split it into two two 100-acre parcels, and each one of those would be able to qualify for a non-farm parcel, actually two non-farm parcels off of each one. What this does is all adds to that and says that parcels created after July 1st, 1999, in its present form, couldn't have new non-farm parcels split off of them. So it even goes beyond the laws that exist today in limiting parcels. It really kind of shuts down the partitioning of large parcels in exchange for allowing some limited partitioning, only two total lots, one new lot, of parcels less than the minimum lot size that is in the statute, the 80-acre minimum lot size.
Mr. Reed, is that it?
Yeah.
Mr. Reed. Of course, I see Crook is involved. Crook County said this was case, and just curious, other Eastern Oregon counties, have you been in touch with them to just see the response to them on this?
Mr. Chair, Senator Duncan, yes, to a certain extent. I try through the Oregon Planning Director Association to do that. Also, I know the Association of Oregon Counties, Art Schlack, has been participating in this process. I have not independently surveyed people on a broad-scale basis, so I have not stopped.
Are those groups, may I continue?
Yes,
are those groups supporting, are they supportive, do you think?
Chair Bryant, Senator Duncan, to my knowledge, they are. I have not heard any opposition to this. I think the one thing that I did say about reducing the ability to split those lots, it's not so hard to regulate lots that don't yet exist. From having parcels that haven't been thought of to be created yet, it's much more difficult to take away rights that people thought they had to divide land today.
Well, sure. I guess that's one question I might have. If you, there's some trade-offs in this, obviously, you know, to make. But okay, this July 1 date. Okay, if you owned 1,000 acres, and you divided it. I just hear 640 and 360. Then you're locked in. The guy with 640 is locked in. Seems he had some unsuitable land requirements, so he's locked in at that point. He could never do any dividing on that land. Is that right?
Sure, Senator Duncan, that is correct. And again, it does significantly limit the ability to keep partitioning land. However, I think it does go a long ways toward meeting what it is that we expect in non-farm, in farm areas that have property that isn't farmland, and that is a limited number of dwellings can be placed in those areas if they go through a very elaborate process and meet some very strict criteria.
I heard it.
Some of the requirements of this bill rely on data, like AUMs and the forest productivity. Are there data available throughout Eastern Oregon to determine which parcels can support more than 5 animal units and also the forest land productivity? Do these data exist so that citizens can participate in the process?
Senator Bryant, Senator Burdick, definitely in our county we have a GIS system. We can print that off relatively easily. I'm uncertain of other counties. I really can't speak for the level of data, but I think these are pretty standardized numbers. I don't think that they're related to soil, so if you have soil mapping, you can generally tell the animal unit productivity. They're related to forest productivity, which is, again, related to soil. So I believe these are relatively easy to ascertain. You know, all of these applications have to go through an individual land use application and be reviewed individually.
Yeah.
And today, these are very, very rigorous standards, very difficult standards. I don't think this presents any more difficulty than we have today in reviewing an application.
I attended the hearing in the House side where Representative Morgan gave extensive testimony about the effect of owners in her particular county. And of course, this now would leave the existing law in effect, the gate law, as it relates to the west side of the mountains, correct?
That is correct.
And was that just a political compromise that was reached by the work group?
Mr. Chair, I believe that is true. I think the west side is very complicated, and there are very, very few parcels that are entirely unsuited. If you look at what we're asking for here on the east side, it's that 90% of the parcel is not class 6 through 8 soils, and that, you know, that's pretty high standard that very few parcels on the west side can meet. And that made it very difficult to come up with a compromise on the west side.
You mentioned absolutely no water right on either parcel?
As proposed, that's my understanding, yes.
So if it's an 80-acre parcel and you have 5 acres of water, you wouldn't call it be able to split it?
That is correct.
And the reason for that, even assuming that all the other qualities were met, the poor soil and it's really marginal farmland?
You're right. That is part of what the compromise was made. I think it's very difficult now to cite non-farm dwelling farm parcels with those characteristics, because if you look at the criteria, basically you have to find it extremely unsuitable for a farm use, period. And if it has 5 acres of water, it probably has some farm capability, and it would be difficult even today, even pre-Dorfman, to approve a dwelling on that kind of parcel, or at least, I'm sorry, to create a parcel that has agricultural productivity. You can get a dwelling on a portion of that parcel that's generally unsuitable, but we're talking about new lots that would be created. You can't create them today.
And that would be true even for 1 acre. I'm trying to remember the Oregon Water Resource Requirement. You can use 1 acre for domestic use. Or is it 1/2 acre? I'm trying to recall. So that you can use it if you wanted to for your domestic water and a little irrigation for lawn, garden, that sort of thing.
Sir, but you may want to legislate history of that. I don't believe that would be covered. We would not consider that irrigated. That would be just normal consumption, not domestic consumption.
But yeah, under this, if you had 1 acre irrigation, you could be disqualified. You'd have to get rid of your 1 acre of water and go through the process of drilling a well.
Right, yes.
All right. Questions for Mr. Reed? Thank you. Ron Ebert from the RCD.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Ron Ebert with the Department of Land Conservation and Development. It's difficult to address this issue this morning because we don't have the specific amendments in front of us. I think the best I can say at this point that certainly the AIM gross version of the bill that's come over from the House, the department is not in support of. We have been part of the working group that has been looking at what is expected to be a proposed compromise on this issue that Mr. Reed has explained to you, and I think Representative Lundquist's office will explain to you. I think the essence of that compromise is that larger farm parcels that exist today could not be divided in such a way consistent with the minimum lot size that they then further remain eligible to divide off additional non-farm parcels. It is non-farm parcels that get divided and introduced in the farm areas that create continuing problems. And we believe that restricting that pool of an increase in non-farm parcels will better protect the agricultural land of the state. In return, the bill would allow existing smaller parcels in the minimum lot size to be divided into two non-farm parcels if, in fact, both of them are not suitable for agriculture. The current standard is generally unsuitable. It's very general. This bill would put in some very specific, clear and objective criteria for determining that, in fact, they are not suitable for agriculture. The existing standards for a dwelling, that it not interfere with the surrounding farm practices, that it not change or alter the land use pattern in the area, would remain in effect. So at this point, we have a conceptual understanding and we're working with the parties on the amendments. I think there's still some details to be worked out, but when the amendments get back, we'll be at the table. So I can answer any questions that you have.
Were you surprised by the result in the Dornovan decision?
Senator, not completely. The statutes were between 215 and 263, which authorized partitioning for non-farm dwellings, and the minimum lot sizes. We had had some discussions during the development of 3661, and it was the understanding that current law would continue. When you create parcels, both parcels have to meet a standard. So I think it was our view that either one parcel could be below the minimum and one above, or if you were dividing a parcel below, they both had to meet the non-farm standard. But in reading the statutes, it was a fair reading of the statutes as it came out.
And not the way people have been operating for about 4.5 years since the 93 change.
Chair Bryant, yeah, I think the practice in looking at the statistics from around the state and the practice was clearly that substandard parcels were divided if both of them could meet the non-farm standard. The issue that we had the most, I think, discussion around in the working group was whether or not you could divide a substandard parcel and one of them not be unsuitable for farm use. There was, I think, one county in particular and a couple in a few scattered instances would make that kind of partition. We did not think that was the law before Dornovan and don't support that approach to the bill.
Thank you. Questions? Yes, Mr. Brown.
Do you feel confident that the total number of new non-farm home sites that can be created and restored will be fewer or smaller than under existing law?
Chair Bryant, Senator Brown, from the numbers that we have seen from Deschutes County, which is a county that is more parcelized than most, we see a net benefit. In other words, we would end up restricting and limiting the number of new on-farm dwellings where new parcels are to be created for them, as opposed to what would be allowed in terms of dividing the pre-existing small parcels.
Has any research been done in any of the counties in Oregon County besides Deschutes?
Senator Bryant, Senator Brown, no.
I think Deschutes has a unique position of one being 80% owned by the state, federal, or local government, and then two, having no good soil. And our climatic situation will push it down. So I think it's been subject to more partitioning because of that. And problem land pushed the demand of the people wanting to move.
Senator Bryant, one additional point. I think in looking at the counties over the years and the level of parcelization and the land use pattern, it would be our impression at least that the other counties in eastern Oregon are made up of much larger ranches and farm parcels with a lot less or a lot smaller number of parcels that are less than the minimum that would be able to divide under the compromise and also meet the rigorous standards for non-farm parcels. So we would, in effect, retain those large ranches and operations for farm purposes and not allow additional non-farms to be divided from those.
Thank you. This information is a couple years old, but I think it might still be true, and that is that a couple years ago, anyway, the figure was bandied around that 50% of the building permits in Deschutes County were issued outside the urban growth boundary. Do you see, this is a farm issue, but it's also a sprawl issue. And in a fast-growing area like Bend and perhaps other parts of eastern Oregon as they're discovered from an economic development standpoint, do you see this as contributing to sprawl in the future and to kind of scattershot development?
Chair Bryant, Senator Burdick, I don't believe so. When I look at the numbers, at least in Deschutes County, the number of new non-farm dwelling parcels that could be created under this bill is very, very small. I think, and when, you know, most of the non-farm dwellings in eastern Oregon come from Crook and Deschutes County and Lake County. Oddly enough, the numbers in the rest of the counties are very small. Mr. Reed may have a better sense on the percentage split of building permits. I think the bigger issue, frankly, in Deschutes County is the number of existing parcels that are eligible for a non-farm dwelling that are less than the minimum lot sizes. I think it's somewhere over 1,000. This bill doesn't affect it. I mean, this bill only deals with creating new parcels for non-farm dwellings, and the numbers we've seen are, it might be a couple hundred, whereas the existing pool of parcels is quite high, and they are eligible for non-farm dwellings if the standards are applied in terms of whether they're truly unsuitable and what effect that has on the land use pattern. If that standard is applied correctly, it should limit that number.
I think it's fair to say that proponents believe that there's a deal being made here in terms of this particular piece of legislation, and you may or may not agree with that, but I guess the question I would ask for you is whether you think the legislature in 2005 or 2007 and 2009 will honor what we've done here today.
Senator Bryant, Senator Brown, I would hope so. We have developed a policy statement to go with the bill explaining the particular trade-off, so to speak, and the purpose behind trying to protect the larger farm parcels. We've done that. Senate Bill 101 in 1973, the Agricultural Land Use Policy, which is in 215-243, another policy statement that was part of 3661. We like to refer to those quite regularly and remind subsequent legislatures of the reason statutes were changed the way they were. Obviously, each legislature has the ability to change things.
Thank you.
Thanks for testimony. Representative Lundquist.
I just point that out, Mr. Chair, if I see the only legislator in the room who has the potential of being here in 2005, it's a senator from Clackamas County.
You wanted him to hear that?
I think he's so focused on his bill, I'm not sure he was listening.
Thank you, Chair Bryant and committee members. Thank you for hearing this bill at this time of the session. I want to make sure you understand that this has gone through a lengthy process. Actually, we started this prior to the session. So we've had a work group, and all of you realize that's how we get things done within these walls. Chair Bryant, if I could have answered the question about that you asked Mr. Eber in regard to whether I was surprised or not, I guess I'd say I was shocked rather than surprised, because as you indicated, we had been under this realm for at least 4.5 years, and activities have been going on that were allowing the non-farm parcel to be divided. So I was extremely shocked, as well as I think the whole state was. Also, I wanted to point out that in our work group, Douglas County did some statistical analysis in regard to whether it be more or less parcels in regard to Senator Brown's comment or question about what's the net effect. And the net effect in Douglas County as well was actually a reduction in potential sites. Mr. Chairman, but you have before you hopefully a little schematic that I think probably does as good a job as possible of depicting what we're really talking about here. The present law shows, and we just use a 300-acre farm parcel as a large parcel being above the minimum. What can happen right now is you can divide two parcels off. You see the non-farm there on the left. But also that parcel can be divided into 300-acre parcels under the present law. And each one of those can have two parcels divided off. Let me just give you a very living example. Some of you know, I sold a considerable part of my farm since before I came in the legislature. It was about 1,200 acres. That farm now is divided into 6 different parcels. four of those parcels would qualify because there are two that are only 80 acres, so you could not strip another two parcels off. But there are four parcels right now, four varying sizes that came from the original 1,200 that could all have two non-farm parcels divided off. Okay? That's present law. That's a very real example, and that's what's going on in some of these areas where people, the person I sold the land to couldn't make it and was trying to keep his resources together. Now, underneath, House Bill 3489 on the bottom of the page shows you the benefits. I hope you can understand there is a true benefit to land use planning in this state by this bill. Because under that scenario, the three parcels we're talking about, only the original one would be able to have the two non-farm parcels split off. I think, committee members, that this is positive land use planning because this tends to keep the parcels larger. It puts pressure on to keep the parcels larger and to not have the non-farms cut off from them. Now, I can tell you some of my constituents don't like this. They realize down the road that's going to be a negative to them. But from a land use standpoint, from true planning, which I hope we are part of doing, then I think this also shows us a benefit. So let's move on to the other page, which is sort of the other side of the coin. Now we're talking about those below the minimum for most tents. In most places, that's 80 acres. Also, I want you to understand, this is non-farm parcels that we're talking about. This is not farmland. Ron Eber mentioned about the fact that the department did not agree with splitting a less than minimum parcel into two parcels where one of them is a farm and the balance is non-farm. And that's not part of this bill. It wasn't originally. It is not part of the bill that you have before you right now. So under the present law, because of the Dorman case, you have 80 acres. You're done. The parent parcel has to remain 80 acres. So you can't do anything. And that's where the crux of the problem came. Under 3489, it shows that we can make one divide. Now, there's one mistake on this schematic, and that is the 20-acre minimum is not in the bill. We had that in there, but the department agreed it was probably better not to say what the minimum acre is.
So that would be left to the county?
That would be left to the county discretion. And I apologize for, I didn't happen to catch that until I looked at just a minute ago. So actually, you could have a 10 and a 70, or however, in the bill, it does state that the two parcels together have to total at least 40 acres. So what this is a very narrow area. If you have 40 acres to 80 acres, you can divide once. If you're below 40 acres, you can't. So it's a very narrow Dorpin fix. It certainly does not go back, Mr. Chair, to where we were. And I would prefer to have three parcels rather than two, and the department knows that. But in negotiating with the governor's office and with the department, this is what we came up with. Mr. Chair, that concludes my comments. Let me take questions.
Questions, Representative Wolf? You came up, you demonstrated it. The question is, if you had 80 acres under current law without House Bill 3489, you would not be able to divide it?
That's absolutely true.
Even though it's non-farm, you have to have a minimum lot, 80 acres.
The remaining parcel has to remain 80 acres, so obviously you can't split anything off if the remaining parcel has to be 80.
Mr.
Chair?
Yeah,
there you go. Mr. Blomquist, on the present law, according to your charts, you've got 3 100-acre parcels, these small squares. Do they represent a dwelling?
Yes. Okay. Those are non, Mr. Chairman of Senator
Arnold. Non-farm dwellings.
Those are non-farm dwellings. Now, those non-farm dwellings have to meet the standards for a non-farm dwelling. It's not automatic. And that's why in the case of my ranch, there are two parcels that wouldn't be able to meet those tests, but the other four could.
And Mr. Chair, one more.
Yes.
None of this is incumbent upon soil types that doesn't enter into the equation. Only at the local level with soil types that are into the equation to determine the cost.
Yeah. Mr. Chairman, Senator Tarnow, for the non-farm parcel, yes, the soil test is part of the bill. There's a series of tests that you have to meet in order to be able to create a non-farm parcel.
very modest bill from where we started.
Mr. Chairman,
I think that's
painfully unfair.
That constitutional problem.
Yes. And we do have the policy statement that you'll have part of when we come back to the final hearing on this.
And when do you think the amendments will be ready?
Friday.
All right. Any other questions? Thanks for your testimony. We'll momentarily set the public hearing on House Bill 3489 because we have testimony that needs to testify on SJR 21. So we'll open the public hearing on that and invite the Senator Metzger and Dave Honeycutt. And then we'll come back to House Bill 3489.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. In the interest of time, I've asked Mr. Honeycutt, Ms. Botkin, to join me too, and we'll do this all at once. SJR 21 before you, and you should have her being distributed now, the Dash 1 amendments, which essentially is pretty well encompasses the bill and is, I would urge their adoption to make this complete. It refers to the 1902 initiative of a referenda legislation that was passed by the people of the state of Oregon. And SJR 21 with the Dash 1 amendments essentially clarifies what was the intent, as legal scholars have long said, of the intent of the electorate to both amend and to add laws to the Constitution, but to do that in the proper place. The successful reformers put the initiative power with that power shows that they understood the existing distinction between laws and amendments to the Constitution, because in the many decades following the 1902 amendment, they employed initiative amendments to propose changes in the institutions, procedures, powers, and programs of government, not to submit laws governing private persons into the Constitution. I have about just 3 minutes of testimony, Mr. Chair. This came to a head in 1994, and then Representative Robert Kiernan initiated a constitutional amendment to require that state employees contribute 6% of their pay to the plan. That was another person's Measure 8. It was challenged by a number of folks, but in one remarkable suit was brought by the plaintiffs headed by former Governors Vic Atiyah, Robert Straub, Dave Frommeyer, a number of justices of the Oregon Supreme Court, against Secretary of State Phil Kiesling, Oregon's chief elections officer. Plaintiffs said that choosing the form of a constitutional amendment in order to place legislation beyond the reach of the legislature was not authorized by the Constitution and contradicted the Oregon Supreme Court's original 1903 defense of the initiative system as a Republican form of lawmaking. Beyond this specific instance of Measure 8, plaintiffs asked the court to declare that the Secretary of State not only has the authority but the obligation to disallow future proposed initiatives if he or she finds that they violate the Guarantee Clause or attempt to place legislation in the Constitution. And after Measure 8 was invalidated on unrelated grounds, the Supreme Court dismissed the case Atiyah versus Kiesling as moot. What SJR 21 with the Dash 1 amendment says and what it does do and what it doesn't do, what it does do is reinforce the original intent of the 1902 law that allows members of the electorate to pass laws or amendments to the Constitution. What it doesn't do is in any way restrict their ability to do that other than to say that they need to be placed in the proper format. This is a fascinating case. I've studied for a long time. We can talk for hours, and I know we don't have that time, but that is the gist of that, and I would like to conclude my testimony and then ask Mr. Honeycutt and Ms. Botkin and then if any questions.
Thank you, Chair Bryant, members of committee, Dave Honeycutt, speaking in support of the Dash 1 amendments to SJR 21. I actually come at this from a little bit different perspective than Senator Metzger. I was a chief petitioner on ballot measure 65, the administrative rule reform measure, and assume that I will be a chief petitioner in the upcoming election cycle on another administrative rule reform measure. In any event, one of the arguments that we faced in measure 65 in the last election cycle was that it could be placed in statute and not in the Constitution. It was a proposed constitutional amendment. I disagree with that. But that argument in the voters' pamphlet, I think, was very damaging to our ballot measure. And as we went along in the process, I thought it would be interesting if we could get a Supreme Court ruling on whether or not this amendment was properly placed in the Constitution, or whether it could be placed in the Oregon Revised Statutes. If we had that, we would eliminate those arguments. Senator Metzger proposed SJR 21. That it would answer the question that we had with Measure 65. I am probably, it's strange, I agree with Lloyd Marbet and with Mr. Sizemore on the initiative process, and I'm a huge defender of the initiative process. At the same time, I think this is a reason major, a good resolution, and one that we would strongly support.
I hope it goes well the next time on your initiative.
Just a couple more points, Senator Duncan. Just a couple more
points. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Mary Bysha. I'm here representing the American Federation of State County Municipal Employees. Mr. Chair, Senator Duncan, I'm with you. You know, this is the yin and the yang, I guess. But be that as it may, we're here in support of Senator Metzger's bill this morning. We believe that over the years the Constitution is becoming cluttered with kind of gravel, myriad of things that are more appropriately placed in statutory law rather than constitutional law. Ballot Measure 8 was our case. It cost us a lot of money to prove what we already knew, and that was it's unconstitutional. And I think we need some kind of a review process. I think we need to appropriately place the initiatives where they belong. And I think that this bill at least starts that process of cleaning up the initiative system. I am not a fan of the initiative system, but I am bound by my client's desire to continue it. You know, our folks don't like fighting initiatives. They haven't supported one in a long time, but they believe that process should continue. This just cleans up a bit, and we think a good bill should pass.
Mr. Chair, just to conclude, in drafting the Dash 1, it came out of a consultation with Charlie Hinkle and Justice Lindy and also David Schuman, the Attorney General's office. The Dash 1 is important because it does provide an appeal process to the Oregon Supreme Court. If, in fact, someone believes the Secretary of State has erred in their determination as to whether something should be constitutional or not. And Mr. Schuman, who's on vacation now, cannot be here, said the Secretary of State was statutes clearly of articulated the Secretary of State as the proper place for funneling things through the initiative process. But again, in conclusion, this basically is a reaffirmation of what the people decided in 1902. It's only been the last few years that this process has been abused, has not been challenged, and this will clarify that. And any other questions you have, we're open for those.
So, is the Attorney General's office in support of SJR 21?
Well, they're neutral on it. As another branch of government, they said they could not either support or oppose it. But Mr. Schuman was very helpful in determining whether this was the proper language for defining the role of the Secretary of State. Secretary of State's opposed to it. You might imagine, I think he's here.
Yeah.
Right. And Hardy Lawyer is going to testify this afternoon at 3:30 as well. Other questions for this panel? Thank you for your testimony.
Thank you very much.
Phil, do you want to testify now?
I'll wait until 3:30.
Okay. Senator Miller.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, State Senator Randy Miller, District 13, I simply wanted to come and testify in opposition to this measure. Listening to the testimony of those who are in support, it's interesting to hear their conclusions that they believe that the citizens of this state have cluttered or attempted to clutter our Constitution as to what is the best policy for this state. They suggest that we should place initiatives where they belong. Whose judgment is that? Apparently that's in conflict with the citizens of this state. Some have said that the process has been abused. Again, that's a value judgment by some legislators, those who are in a position of power and who, by virtue of this measure, want to make sure they stay in power as opposed to granting the citizens of this state the right to exercise their will. Frankly, I think this is a very bad proposal. It is, I think, an indication of the power struggle that goes on between those of us who are put in this position, in this capital, versus the citizens who have the right to initiate changes in this state, who can make a judgment as to whether or not their constitution is altered. This isn't just the constitution that can be changed by the legislature. This is something the people will make a judgment about. One of the things that goes on in a campaign regarding an initiative is whether or not some think it the subject belongs in the Constitution or in the statutes. Some may see that as a positive. Some out there who are going to be asked to vote on the question will see that as a negative. If they conclude, no, we don't want to clutter the Constitution with whatever subject is proposed, I guess that's a reason they would vote no. If they vote yes, then I think that stands for the proposition that the subject matter in the minds of the voters of this state did not clutter their Constitution. Again, this is not our document. I know we've got a lot of people who have a lot of endearment, I guess, for the Constitution as it currently stands, but that too is an evolving document, just as are the statutes. Now, I know that many think that there are some measures that belong in the statute, but I think we also have to know why so many of our citizens have chosen to try to change the Constitution, and that is because their fear that we will instantly have the authority to change their view. And placing things in statute obviously gives us the license, the ability to make quick change, and we've done so on several occasions, much to the consternation of our citizens who have been forced to try to put things into the Constitution that perhaps they wouldn't otherwise choose to do. But I hope this committee will think long and hard about pursuing this particular matter in light of what I believe is usually our expressed desire when we get elected and have the trust of our citizens, and that is that we also have confidence in their judgment. And this measure certainly doesn't respect that view. I thank you very much for your time and your consideration.
Hey, Guy.
Mr. Chair and Senator Miller, I know of your great respect for the judgment of the people, and I certainly admire that. And that's what we're asking, isn't it? This would be sent to them for their judgment?
That's correct.
We would be able to trust their judgment.
I don't believe that this is worthy of being sent to the people because I would suggest this, that if that's the reason for the vote, if you want to make one of those speeches on the floor, Mr. Chairman, Senator Duncan, that says, I really don't believe in this. I really don't think that we ought to interfere with the right of the people to initiate or to petition their government. That's fine. I guess you can make that speech. But frankly, I don't think this is worthy of their consideration. I think they would appropriately view it as an invasion of their authority and their power.
Mr. Chair, I guess I keep hearing from people. In fact, even this week, I've had several people tell me that they say, why in the world don't you folks check things out before you put it on the ballot? Well, obviously, we're not experts beforehand, but I think there is some concern about it, and I think that gets added to some extent. That's why I...
Well, I say, Mr. Chairman, Senator Duncan, when you heard about the procedure here, we can have it reviewed and go through appeals if they disagree with the Secretary of State's opinion. I mean, that's a wonderful procedure, but it's additional hurdles for people to make changes they feel are required and desirous. And what is to give us confidence that we think that both the Secretary of State's office or the court, for that matter, is apolitical? They're very political.
Ever.
Yeah, you talk about the citizens having their voice on constitutional amendments, but isn't it just a matter with paid signatures being so prevalent now, with very few measures getting on that aren't paid? Vote by mail was one exception that I think really was a citizen initiative, and actually that was a statutory change, I believe, as well.
That was not also just exclusively voluntary, as you know.
Well, it was.
No, it was not.
Well,
there were paid.
Well, there was paid staff, but they did not pay the signatures, and I was a volunteer signature gatherer. But either as it may, with paid signatures, don't you think it's really true that what the citizens get to respond to is the subject matter, and it's really up to the person who has a vested interest and pays big bucks to get it on the ballot. Those are the people now who are determining whether it's a constitutional or statutory measure, not citizens.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Burdick, as a matter of fact, it is a citizen. Because no matter how much pay you have for petition signature gatherers, it seems to me they're citizens of this state need to sign the petition. They aren't paid to sign because that would be prohibited by law. There are people who are paid to gather signatures, but the Oregonian who signs or agrees not to sign a petition is the one that determines whether or not a measure will be placed on the ballot. That's just the first step. And then there's the second step, and that's the actual question placed in front of the citizens of this state. They choose to adopt a measure that goes into the Constitution or the statutes. That is their choice. And why people want to interfere with that right, that ability, is beyond me.
To follow up,
yeah, but
don't you think that the citizens are responding more to the subject matter than to the issue of whether it's going in the Constitution or in the statute?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Burdick, I think there's a whole host of reasons that people choose to sign or not sign petitions. They may want to further a discussion. They may wholeheartedly support the discussion. I'm sure there are plenty who sign petitions that they haven't perhaps fully read or comprehended. But during the course of the debate before an initiative becomes something adopted by the people, there is ample opportunity for them to fully appreciate the details, and they will vote yes, they will vote no. Again, I think we ought to respect their judgment and not try to interfere with their right to exercise this authority.
Randy, do you ever see a risk of us losing the Republican form of government through the initiative process, where because of the initiatives, our role as legislators more or less, well, is significantly reduced, and that there could be a strong constitutional argument that the initiative process has gone too far when it restricts the elected representatives from being a Republican form of government?
Mr. Chairman, I don't see that currently, and I don't forecast that. Again, this is a right the citizens have in this state. They exercise it, I think, with due care. We aren't overrun with initiatives. We aren't overrun with successful initiatives. The people exercise, I think, in great part, a very wise judgment on these matters. There are times, I'm sure, when we will all disagree with their judgment, as we have a right to do. But I think we also have to respect what the citizens of this state do through the initiative. When you think about it, I think, and Secretary Keith, maybe he's gone, maybe he's here. I don't recall how many initiatives were on the ballot. It seems to me in the nature of 20 in the last cycle, and there might have been less than half of that actually adopted by the citizens of this state.
About five.
So five out of about 20, I think, is an accurate figure. That doesn't strike me as the people being, you know, overly aggressive on changing the nature of this state. And I also submit to you that in the event that they do, and they become increasingly active through the initiative, it usually is a result of a legislature, government in this body, whether it's the legislature, whether it's the executive not agreeing with the decision of the legislature, that causes people to become active because they're dissatisfied in our work product. So they seek a way to change it. And I would just, again, not like to see us through this, what I consider a power grab, shut them off.
Yeah. Well, it is a limitation because it would push to the statutory means many issues that are now trying to be placed in the Constitution. I have a constitutional scholar next to me who has written me a note saying, as of 1996, the Oregon Constitution has been amended 201 times.
Mr. How many times do you have Constitution amended?
35?
I'm not exactly. I've been in that area. Huh?
It's not as easy to amend. I have a question for any more.
Thank you, Mr. Holmes.
We will at least have a public hearing on this SJR 21 until this afternoon at 3:30. We will now go back into the public hearing on House Bill 349. I invite Blair Batson and Art Schlack.
Good morning, Chair Bryant, members of the committee. My name is Blair Batson. I'm representing 1,000 Friends of Oregon. 1,000 Friends of Oregon opposed House Bill 3489 on the House side, and we haven't had the opportunity to see the written amendments that I guess you're hearing. They've been described to us, and they were described to you this morning, and we have considerable concerns about those amendments. So I'd like right now to go back a little bit and set some context and then talk a little bit about the deal as we understand it and why we're concerned. I think, as you know, Oregon law now maintains agricultural land base through three basic tools. They have urban growth boundaries. Their purpose is to keep urbanization out of the EFU zones, the exclusive farm use zones. Within the zones, we have laws that limit non-farm uses, and we have laws that limit land divisions. In 1993, the legislature passed House Bill 3661. Some of you were part of that. And the basic deal that was cut in that session was an understanding that we were going to put increased limitations on land divisions in exchange for allowing more opportunities for houses on existing parcels. The view was we have landowners out there who really, really want a house, and for whatever reason, we're going to give it to them. But we're going to limit the ongoing division of land for speculative development because we don't really think that's just for policy reasons for allowing more development in farmland. So part of that deal in terms of limiting the land divisions was adopting objective numeric minimum parcel sizes. That means in farm zones, you have to adopt a minimum parcel size below which you can't divide a parcel. It's a straight number, 80 acres, 40 acres, 160 acres. We'd had minimum parcel sizes before that, but they hadn't been very effective because they had standard sites. The parcel must be appropriate to maintain the existing agricultural use in the area. And when that was applied on a case-by-case basis, you got pretty inconsistent results. So this was a great step forward. In addition, there was an absolute bar on dividing land or non-farm home sites in the Willamette Valley, another great advance. Outside the valley, the deal was you can divide off any portion of an existing parcel that's unsuitable for farm production. But the remaining parcel, what's left, must be aggregated with another parcel to meet the minimum parcel size. If by itself it does not. That's what the Dorvin case clarified. The Court of Appeals affirmed Luba in clarifying that was what 3661 said. We think that's good policy. What 3489 is trying to come back and do is say those parcels that now meet the minimum parcel size, which the Dorvin case clarified could not be divided unless the remainder was then aggregated with another parcel so that it could be the size of a farm parcel. You can divide them anyway. Existing parcels, meaning existing minimum parcel size, they may be divided into two non-farm home sites. We think that's bad policy. The department shares those concerns, but believes that the gains that are proposed by the particular deal that's being discussed outweigh that. So their hope is that the overall impact of the bill will be to limit non-farm home sites. So here's what the deal does and why we're concerned. First of all, there are so-called tougher criteria for how the for getting the non-farm home site. Those are the AUM criteria and the FAR Strategic Growth Site Class Index. We agree that if those could be applied uniformly, they'd be tougher than what's out there now. They're clear and objective. But there are not uniform soil surveys that have this information available for all counties. What we're concerned about is when that information is not available, as it's happened in the past, the counties may say, well, there's no data on that, therefore we can't do the ranking, therefore you don't have to meet the criteria. That has happened in the past with similar criteria. Or the applicant can hire an expert to say what the soil ratings are, and that isn't usually a very reliable form of determining what the appropriate criteria is. In addition, there's a policy that's added that says an existing farm parcel, a parcel that meets the minimum parcel size that created after July 1, 1999, can never, ever, ever, ever be divided again for non-farm use. We question, first, the wisdom, is that good policy? If you have a rancher who's out in Harney County, he has a 1,000-acre parcel, next month he divides it into a 640 and a 360, and then he's told in 2 years that he can't divide off a piece for an unsuitable piece for a non-farm house. Well, is that really a good policy? Is that really what we're trying to do out there? So we question that, and we question it particularly because the pressure right now for the division, where this non-farm home site pressure is going, are on these parcels that meet the minimum parcel size and are smaller. So the bill will say, okay, we can have this non-farm home site development, pressure development, where the pressure is now. We're going to protect this land, and we really don't have any pressure. We're not sure that's a particularly wise deal from the point of view of the interest of folks interested in maintaining agricultural land. So in conclusion, we question the wisdom of this deal. It's difficult to say conclusively how it will all come out on the ground. There's not enough data to support really any ultimate conclusion. We think it would be wiser, if you're interested in pursuing this, to ask that a study be done or to abandon it altogether. We don't see a great demand, a great need to change existing policy. We think it's good. But there's really no way to understand what the impacts of this deal are. On the positive side, the negative impacts are quite apparent. You're going to open up a lot of existing parcels that are protected under clear and objective standards to non-farm home site development in Eastern Oregon. And we don't think that's good for the agricultural community, so we would urge you to reduce the dollar. Thank you.
Ms. Slack. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Art Slack. I'm with the Association of Oregon Counties. And I might say, Mr. Chair, that I was involved in the development of House Bill 3661, so I have a little bit of background. And it was my understanding that the legislature, when it was adopted, was within that bill had a Smith fix, what was called a Smith fix, for those portions of the state outside of the Willamette Valley. So we were more than mildly surprised with the Dorvenin decision at this point. We have been involved with the work group and eagerly await the amendments at this point to see if they carry out the intent of, and the discussions that we've had. We certainly support a fix to the Dorvenin case for Eastern Oregon and also Southern Oregon if one can be developed at some point in the future. This bill does not affect the Willamette Valley. Let me repeat that. It does not affect the Willamette Valley. It would only affect, at this point, Eastern Oregon, is my understanding. And there is one additional point in terms of what was discussed with you earlier that at least that I would like to get on the record. There will be a provision for what we call, what we referred to as a go-blow. We'll note that as Representative Lundquist described the bill, that you could only create two parcels rather than three, which you can do currently under law. You can create three parcels in a partition. If you create four parcels, it's a subdivision, and you can't do a subdivision on agriculture or forest land. The point is that there will be a provision that a county can go before LCDC based on detailed information
in terms of the number of parcels that could be created and the partitioning that could be done, and asked for approval to allow a total of 3 parcels to be created in a partition, with the 2 as basically a, shall we say, a safe harbor at this point. We understand it's difficult to get a total picture of the number of parcels that could be created at this point. The safe harbor is 2. It's the parent parcel and 1 additional. And then a county going before LCDC with detailed information can ask for the commission's approval to allow 3 parcels to be created, where they can show that it will not have a detrimental impact on the agricultural base within a region or the county as a whole. And that is, you know, again, I think a safeguard that not a lot of undue partitioning will be established, but still give a county, based on detailed information, an opportunity to go before the commission and make its case. And I think that's an essential part of what's being discussed in the bill, and I just wanted to get that on the record, Mr. Chair.
Is that part of the amendments that are being drafted now?
Yes, it is. It was discussed early on, and it will be in the amendments that you will receive.
We anticipate receiving those Friday. So that's the case. This will probably be rescheduled at 1 o'clock on Friday, and we'll discuss those amendments then. Thank you. Are there other questions? Thank you for your testimony. With that, we'll close the public hearing and open a work session on House Bill 2535 and invite Representative Manning. Eddie, this is a work session. As you know, when we discussed Senate Bill 700, we had public hearings for, I think, 3 days and several work sessions on that particular bill. The way this bill has been presented to us, it is intended not to omit it's a delicate compromise that has been crafted. And so what I've invited is Representative Manix here today to explain what the bill does. And as you'll see, it does differ from Senate Bill 700. And I think it's appropriate to be very candid and say this is going to be the bill that either moves from the committee or doesn't move from the committee. And so that's why we have the work session today.
Mm-hmm.
Yep. Good morning, and welcome to Senate Judiciary.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. I'm Representative Kevin Manish from Salem, and I appreciate the opportunity to speak to you briefly this morning during this work session on House Bill 2535. One of the members of your committee, Senator Burdick, is quite intimately familiar with the details of House Bill 2535, since I think he spent as much time on the House floor during the work on this legislation as the other members of the House. So I won't pretend to be here just to answer questions. I am here, of course, to encourage your support for this legislation. What I wanted to do is just mention a couple of themes of the bill and leave it up to the committee members as to whether you would like to ask questions beyond that. The theme of House Bill 2535 is that it was a little bit broader based than Senate Bill 700, and it approached the question of background checks from a slightly different perspective. Our different perspective was to encourage citizen access to the background check system so that any citizen who is contemplating transferring a firearm would be able to call a toll-free number and get a background check, whether or not they were a dealer at a gun show or whatever. And to encourage that, we included in the bill the grant of civil immunity as to any subsequent use by the transferee if the transferor made that call and got a clearance from the state police on a background check. There is a charge for that. A person can use a credit card and call in and get the clearance or non-clearance. And they pay initially $10, but quickly it drops down to $8.50. That's capped in the statute. They can use their credit card over the phone, and over time, as the cost of the system go down, that price can go down. So that is one of the essential features, which is to encourage any citizen to do a background check. Then there is a requirement part, but I'll pause and see. The requirement part has to do with any person who transfers more than 25 firearms a year. Once they hit that level, they stay under this requirement until they've had a calendar year in which they have not transferred over 25 firearms. that anyone who transfers more than 25 firearms in a year needs to do background checks. They are required to do so. And anyone who is present at an event or place where over 25 firearms are available for transfer, sale basically, has to do background checks. And in those cases, again, you call the same toll-free number. In all situations, this applies to long guns and handguns. We shift away from the federal system, which is what we have right now. We have a bifurcated system where long gun background checks are done with the feds and handgun background checks are done with the state police. And instead, all background checks are done with the state police. Some other states, and indeed perhaps at the federal level of the Congress, may take heed as to the approach we're taking. I've heard that Congressman DeFazio has taken interest in the idea of citizen access to the background check system. Right now, citizens are prohibited from having access to a background check unless they are a dealer. And House Bill 2535 moves in the opposite direction that says anybody can call. It's important to note that when you call, you don't get the person's criminal history. You get a clearance or a non-clearance, or you're told an investigation is required because something has come up, and then as soon as that investigation is concluded, you can get the clearance or non-clearance. So it's not as though you get to call up and find out what someone's rap sheet is all about.
Mr. Chair and Representative Manning, I'm just curious. I have a young gentleman in my office yesterday concerned about maybe the gun show. He might buy a number of guns from different vendors there, and each one would take a check, and then it was $8 or something like that for the checker. And I'm wondering, would it be out of line, for example, at a gun show, for them to have a central place where one could get the check and then a verification that you could take the various vendors with? Would that be prohibited through this
bill? Mr. Chairman, Senator Duncan, that's not prohibited by this bill. In fact, it's contemplated by the bill, which has a provision in it that says that the state police can work with vendors to establish a multiple background check system for a particular event for a particular day and reduce the charge. There will be still some small charge if they're including information on separate firearms transactions, but you get the multiple transaction discount, and you could arrange to do it through one large check at such a show. The other parts of the bill have to do with a number of details in the laws in regard to firearms possession. I think the most significant ones have to do on the one side with access to firearms and on the other citizens who are not criminals who are possessing firearms. As to access to firearms, there is a provision which encourages anyone who has a firearm to keep it locked up or to put a trigger lock on it. That encouragement comes from this. If you have it locked up or you have a trigger lock on it and someone overcomes that system and uses that firearm, you will not be liable. That is, a citizen who used those security systems is provided with immunity from liability as their reward, in effect, for having safely stored the firearm. In addition, there's a provision which puts a bit of a penalty on it. It's a fairly small penalty, but it allows us to at least say this is illegal under the law. That is, if you have a person under the age of 15 in your home and that person is not supervised by an adult, you should not be leaving a loaded firearm accessible to that person. If the person accesses that firearm and uses it to injure someone within 24 hours, then you've committed a violation. And the idea here is not so much to impose a big penalty, but to be able to establish as a legal standard that it's illegal to leave a loaded firearm accessible to a minor in your home. You just shouldn't do it. It should be inaccessible to the minor, or it should be locked up. On the other side, for the law-abiding citizen who may inadvertently carry a handgun on his or her person, the person who has no criminal record whatsoever and is not committing another offense at the time, we do change the law so that it's no longer a Class A misdemeanor on the first offense for such a person who would be carrying a concealed handgun without a permit. It becomes a violation. That would give the good, honest citizen a first warning without giving them a criminal record, that in Oregon you are supposed to have a concealed handgun permit before you carry a concealed handgun. But that is a way of allowing citizens some free play when they don't have a criminal record and they are not committing another offense at the time. That was a balancing provision designed to, again, be considerate of law-abiding citizens at the same time that we're going after folks who are felons and we don't want them to have access to firearms. There are a number of other interesting provisions in the bill. I'll mention them and just touch on them. For instance, If a felon is at a gun show with an intent to acquire a firearm, that felon has just committed a crime. The idea being felons shouldn't be at gun shows, and in fact, if they are there, they will be arrested. Simple as that.
They still have to make an attempt. It has to be established
they have an intent if they're in a place where firearms are available. But there's another provision in the bill that has to do with specifically being in a place that is just providing firearms, and a felon can't be present there. It's like a minor being in a place where alcohol is being sold. Can't be there. Got to leave. And it's expected that gun shows will post signs saying no felons allowed on these premises. Which sends a very clear signal about who we're really after, which is criminals who should not have access to firearms. With that, I think I've mentioned enough of the high points of the bill, and I welcome any questions.
You mentioned the work group and that there were compromises made. Could you tell us who the members of the work group were, what organization?
The Oregon State Police, the Oregon State Sheriff's Association, the Oregon Chiefs of Police, the Oregon District Attorneys Association, and through the state police, I'd say, two representatives of the governor, the Oregon Gun Owners, and the National Rifle Association. The Oregon Gun Owners support this legislation. The National Rifle Association is neutral on this legislation. There's another group called Gun Owners of America who vehemently oppose this legislation. They were not invited into the work group because, as far as I was concerned, they were not interested in a positive solution. And so I think that pretty well describes who was involved.
The one of the compromises that was made deals with Sections 10 and 11 and the exemption for public records dealing with concealed handguns. And I've received letters concerning this, including a letter today from the Oregon Newspaper Association, who doesn't oppose the bill but doesn't like that section. And could you just briefly talk about the reasons for that exemption?
Certainly. First of all, I'll mention it's not an absolute exemption. As you are aware, Mr. Chair, it's in a part of the statute that allows you to overcome that exemption for if you establish appropriate reasons, so that there is some access to these records. But the main theme that we heard was that persons who apply for concealed handgun permits are concerned about other people knowing that they possess firearms and other people knowing that they may have a special reason to want to carry a concealed handgun permit, such as they may be in a business where they're carrying valuables, they may be in a business where they feel that they have valuables on the premises, that they could become targeted through having such a permit and having it public that they are a permit holder. And these concerns were expressed, and they appeared to be heartfelt, and it was a concession that was included in the legislation.
Other questions?
Just to pursue that, I've been getting a lot of information from actually opposition from a wide variety of people. On the exemption from the public records, and one of the groups that is expressing concern about this, in addition to the newspaper publishers, is people who run shelters, for example, for abused women or whatever, who sometimes do checks when these women get visitors into the shelter. They sometimes do checks to see if the person who's visiting, if they have any questions, whether that person is carrying a firearm. In your view, would the needs of those people to check out possible armed people coming into an environment like this, would that meet the criteria for being able to determine whether someone has a firearm, getting around the exemption?
Considering, Mr. Chairman, Senator Burdick, considering the statistical information that's available about the amount of violence that surrounds the folks who need to go to shelters, if there's an individual who is associated with that situation, I think it's appropriate for them to be able to overcome that would be a sufficient reason to be able to check to see whether someone has a concealed handgun permit. I would add quickly, however, that in my own view, I've said I do think that's legitimate. In my own view, people who get concealed handgun permits are usually much more law-abiding than the general run of citizenry and usually less dangerous, and it's more likely that a person who is engaged in that kind of conduct didn't bother to get a permit in the first place. But it certainly is an opportunity for them to check to see if someone might have a concealed handgun.
And this concern has also been raised by people who, in the course of their business, for example, people who do repossession of vehicles, sometimes do checks to see if or there's a service actually that provides checks to see if the person they're repossessing the vehicle has a concealed weapon. In your view, would that be a sufficient ground to get around the exemption?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Burke, I'd say in specific instances, I think they're going to have to provide some basis for it. The other situation that you mentioned, having to do with shelters and having to do with persons who are already seeking shelter from a violent situation, we already know that there's some violence that often surrounds that relationship. When you're going to repossess vehicles, there's not necessarily that component. I will be honest and say I think you're going to have a harder time making the case on a global basis. They could probably make the case on a case-by-case basis.
And, Mr. Chairman, just to follow up finally, isn't it true that in the statute, having a committee of crime while you have a permit is a cause for revocation of the permit? But there's not an actual requirement that the permit be revoked. Isn't that correct?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Burdick, that's my understanding. While I haven't specifically looked that up, although I would be very much surprised if it didn't almost happen automatically.
It doesn't, but...
Well, in the sense that any judge that's aware of that, you're dealing with someone who's committed a crime, ought to make sure that there's a revocation, in my opinion.
Thank you.
Okay, Colonel.
This is managed under the staff measure summary. I read here, it says the state police will purge background checks on a periodic basis, and I'm showing the handgun's 5 years, liquor retention, and the long gun is 2. When you say periodic, what does that really mean?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Tarnow, it means that they have to regularly go in and actually purge the records. And to me, that would mean once we get the system going on a monthly basis, to give them a few, perhaps 30 days leeway. It's not meant that they get to wait a year beyond the deadline. And by the way, 60 days on long gun purchasers, and 2 years on, there's two time frames for long guns. It's 2 years on the transferor and 60 days on the transferee, if I recall.
Mr. Chair, just a second. I remember, what is the under Brady, what is the retention rate timeframe?
It's, Mr. Chairman, Senator Tarnow, as I understand it, under the federal system, they're supposed to get rid of records after 60 days. I say supposed to because there's some contention as to whether or not they really do so.
Thank you.
I have a question. Just a comment, last night, as you know, I was recovering from the flu, and I was watching television, and on the Arts and Entertainment Station, they did a special on gun control, gun shows, and it continues tonight, and it's doing very well now, and it's seeing both sides of the issue, and talked to a wide variety of groups, including the author of the book, More Guns, Less Crime, he was interviewed extensively. The executive director of the Gun Owners of America testified, and it was a very balanced approach to the issue, and it's something that just about every state right now is addressing along with the federal government. So if people are interested, they're going to continue. But they also went back to the first federal legislation, which came after the assassination of the Kennedys and Martin Luther King. It went for about 27 years, and then it was after Brady was shot, and of course the Brady. But they interviewed Black Panthers from the 60s and early 70s, and they realized that they had the right to bear arms in public places, and in Oakland, California, they did because they felt that the police were unfair in the way they were enforcing the law. They
road behind the police car burned. And they let the officers know this, but they weren't violating the law in doing it. But the argument was it created more of a balance enforcement of the laws in the predominantly black areas. And then they had a discussion with Randy Weaver, who's a very articulate witness, and I think went through his situation, which was clearly, I think, an abuse forced by the FBI and drug and alcohol people. But then Larry Craig, conservative senator from the state of Idaho, explained his position, and they had a long discussion on militias. And so I felt like they were testifying in front of the Officer Senate Judiciary Committee, because it's certainly a testimony we've heard. And I know the committee is very sensitive and cautious as we proceed through this, and it will be a good debate on the Senate floor, as you have in the House, and we'll see what happens. But I know it's difficult to step into this quagmire and try and come up with a bill, so my compliments to you for your courage and your ability of both you and your committee to come up with compromise. And it truly is a compromise. There are things in this that I like, and things in this I'm not particularly pleased with, but I'm also convinced it's our only opportunity this session to have a bill, and so I'm going to be supporting it.
If I could just add to that, I think it's appropriate. I always like it when Representative Mannix wears his white coat. I call it his magician coat, and I like it when he wears that in his bill, because as the author of Senate Bill 700, this committee took it the issue very seriously. It was a very narrow bill. It did one thing and only one thing, and I honestly thought that that is the best we could do through this session. And I just want to say how pleased I am that you and your team proved me wrong. I wasn't at the table, but I watched what was going on very closely, and I too have heartburn over some of the things in the bill, and I want us to continue to look at it in future sessions and see how all this works on the ground. But it was an amazing product you turned up, and you kept everybody on board. And you satisfied the concerns of the law enforcement community, whose issue this really is. This is a law enforcement bill, and yet you got the cooperation of the moderate part of the gun lobby, and I think that's just one heck of an accomplishment. So I want to commend you for doing that.
Thank you very much.
Other questions or comments?
I think that was a great exit line for me.
Yep. The chair then would move House Bill 2535, de-engrossed, to the floor of the Senate with a due pass recommendation. Is there discussion? Is there objection?
I'll be the moment.
I'll be an officer.
Please indicate that Senator Nelson and Tarna will be noted.
Mr. Chairman, we're in this all okay here.
All right. We have the carries. The chair will carry the bill. We'll now go into work session on House Bill 2396. Mr. Hardy.
Mr. Chairman, the committee has before it the dash A2 amendment, and as the committee may recall, there was a conceptual amendment approximately a week and a half ago that the committee made. Legislative Council advised that with that conceptual amendment, there could be some technical problems. The A2 amendments are designed to do what the committee wanted to do, and Kathy Osborne from the Juvenile Rights Project pointed out one small conceptual amendment that should be made to the A2 amendments, and what that is on page 3, line 1, to insert along with those statutes, 4S-177.
The amendment part?
On the amendment part. That would be page 3, line 1. There's a list of statutes which describe the statutes under which a juvenile can be referred to adult court. And to add to that list of statutes, ORS 137705B-A would make that list complete. The DAs and the defense community, as I understand it, are both copacetic with that.
So we are in work session, and I would move that conceptual amendment. I'd like you to restate it again for the record, if you could, Joe.
Certainly, Mr. Chairman. On page 3, line 1, add to the list of statutes ORS 137707, sub 5, sub B, sub large A.
The Chair would move that conceptual amendment to the dash H2 amendment. Is there discussion? Is there objection? So ordered. Senator Courtney then moved the dash H2 amendment as conceptually amended to the bill. Is there discussion? Objection?
Ordered. Bill for the presentation.
Thank you. Senator Courtney then moved House Bill 2396 to the floor as amended with the due pass recommendation. Discussion? Objection? Ordered. And who's our carry on that?
Senator Charnow had been carried.
Did you carry?
Thank you.
Senator Charnow will carry. Let's see. We've done that. I'm waiting for, as soon as Representative Simmons enters, we'll go to his bill, but I'm now going to a work session on 2462.
Mr. Chairman, the committee has already had a hearing on this bill, which is the civil compromise fix. There are the A4 and the A5 amendments before the committee. Currently, the bill would add a requirement to the law that requires the district attorney to consent to the civil compromise. Again, that is not the state of the current law, and the A4 amendments would remove that requirement, and I understand those were requested by the committee. The defense community supports that, and I believe the DA's association is neutral on that.
They told me this wouldn't give them heartburn to adopt it. Senator Courtney then moves the dash A4 amendments to House Bill 2462. Discussion? Objection? One more amendment.
Mr. Chairman, the committee also has before the A5 amendments, which was a technical fix requested by Ann Christen to further define costs as that would pertain to civil compromise situations.
Move. What is it? It's A5.
I'm
going to be A5, 2462, please.
The A5 amendments have been moved by Senator Courtney to the bill. Discussion? Objection? Supported?
Move the bill. House Bill 2462 is amended to the floor. Due pass recommendation.
Thank you. Senator Courtney moves House Bill 2462 is amended to the floor with the due pass recommendation. Discussion? Objection? Supported?
Sure.
And Senator Courtney, carry. Thank you.
Okay.
Okay. We're waiting for Representative Simmons on House Bill 2706. He's on his way down. There's committee's information on HGR 89 and 93. The reason they're coming back for possible reconsideration is that in, there's a small ambiguity that needs to be discussed. How long are you going to be in the Okay. We'll now open a public hearing on House Bill 2706 and invite Representative Mark Simmons. How's that for an entrance?
That's quite an entrance.
Thank you, Chair Bryant, members of the committee. And I appreciate all the legal expertise we have at our disposal this morning. What we have is a little bill that I introduced at the request of some constituents in Wallowa County. And it comes as a result of a court case. And as the story goes, Don and Marianne Woodward were from Wallowa, sold some logs to Rogie Wood Products Company in Wallowa. And hired their own logging contractor to come on their property and do the felling and the bucking and limbing and then haul those logs to the mill. Well, before they were paid, Rogie Wood Products Company went bankrupt. And so Mr. Woodward, being the good citizen that he is, he had hired his own logger to do the work, so he paid the logger out of his own pocket. Then found out that he didn't have a lien, that the logger had a lien, but he didn't. And what this little bill does is clarifies that the landowner would have a lien if he had hired his own logger to do the work. The way the law reads currently, as I understand this, and you have a copy of the court case before you, is that if you sell the logs to the mill and the mill hires the logger to do the work, that you do have a lien. But if you hire the logger yourself, that you don't. And what this does, this bill just simply two little words, actually four little words on the back side of the bill, paragraph 16, adds felled logs to the definition of timbers, and down line 24 adds a person who hires or permits another to go on the land of the person to obtain the timbers. So, the court did rule that the issue before them was a matter for legislative rather than judicial. Resolution, and you'll find that on page 6 of the court case, down about line 16. Sorry, in line 10, the statute does not contemplate a timberland owner who felled logs rather than sending timber, who arranges for an independent contractor to cut and deliver the timber, and who retains ownership until the logs reach the ultimate purchaser. If the plaintiff is correct, that the statute thereby excludes most contemporary sales between timberland owners and purchasers of logs, that is a matter for legislative, not judicial, resolution. And so you have the bill before you. And what I did is I presented a copy of this court case to legislative counsel and asked them to draft a remedy to that. And the bill before you is as it came back from legislative counsel. It came out of the House Judiciary Committee without amendment. And if you ask me too many questions, I probably can't answer them. So happy to be at your mercy here this morning.
And the owner who wants to avail them of themselves to the lien would have to fall under the requirements of our 4F87 and file the lien within a certain period of time. I'm not familiar with this particular section. But for instance, on construction lien, it's usually 75 days from the date that the work is completed or the day you last work. Do you recall, Mark, what it is for? What time frame would be required for an owner to file the lien?
I don't have a specific answer to that, no.
I can look it up in the staff, but I'm sure this just falls into whatever that statutory framework was. There was one other person signed up to testify who had to take the son of the doctor, that's Tim Martinez. He had some concerns as related to the Oregon Bankers Association. I don't know if you had an opportunity to talk to him about what his concerns were.
Only briefly and some time ago. And it seems that the concern was resolved after further discussion of the bill, but I'd be happy to ask him.
Because I would believe that, let's say there's a mortgage on the property that would cover trees growing and felled, that it would be advantageous to the bank to allow the lien to be filed, because then if you're a property owner, can get the money, that means there's more money for payment of the bank.
It would seem so to me. Certainly seems so.
Yes, and you?
Yes, sir, I believe it has something to do, it was related to the fact that if the bank in fact has a lien on the inventory of the operation holding consistent with the constituent's logs, then there would be some, I guess I had some concern about whether or not that inventory, the lien on that inventory, you know, how specific it would need to be with regard to what items in the inventory that they actually have a lien on, and whether or not the prioritization would be.
Okay. So his concern would be the log purchaser's
end of it.
Right.
And how that might be encumbered.
Right. And so that the bank has a blanket lien on all personal property, equipment, inventory, and goes into the inventory, and the person who goes bankrupt. So the bank claims an interest in it, and the owner would file the lien.
Then what happens?
And how do you work that solution out?
Mm-hmm. And one reason this was important to me is that the way Mr. Woodward went about hiring his own contractors, how most people do their business, at least in Northeast Oregon. You hire somebody you know that happens to be a little logger, and he comes in and cuts the logs for you, and then they're delivered to the mill. And the mill doesn't, in most cases, for small landowners anyway, hire the logging contractor that comes on and does the work. And so they are all unwittingly exposed to the mill go bankrupt.
Mm-hmm. Right. They would be. Okay. Well, we'll continue this and recess. Martinez should be here this afternoon with
thank you very much.
Civic objection and try and find a solution if you can. And on your other bill, all of you are hearing right now. I can give you an update on the other one.
Okay.
We will be in recess until 2 this afternoon. Watch the Senate carefully. 2 is an optimistic time. Once the Rules Committee, which needs that 1 is complete, then we can go into judiciary and maintain an adequate quorum. So 2 is our goal, and it should be somewhere close to that. Thank you, Senator.
In the same room?
Same room.
Senator Bryant, yeah.
open the public hearing once again on 2706 and invite Tim Martinez.
Mr. Chairman, member of the committee, thank you very much. I apologize for having to leave this morning, and I appreciate you taking testimony again this afternoon. 2706, I'm sure Representative Simmons went through the facts behind the what led him to introduce this bill. And unfortunately, we have spent about 25 years fighting what we call secret liens that are in several parts of Chapter 87 of the ORF. This would be another one. We believe that while what happened to his constituents was regrettable, it could have been avoidable if at the very beginning when the timber was cut and harvested, if he'd have performed a UCC filing on that timber. That would have prevented all of the bad things that happened to him down the road when the Rogi wood products that he sold to went bankrupt. I've had a chance to meet with Representative Simmons since your hearing this morning, and he's agreed that we should continue to talk and see if there isn't a way to try to resolve this and see if there isn't a way to perhaps help his folks understand the UCC filing system or indeed put something in statute that requires them to go down that road. I've talked briefly with my counsel, Tim Sherman, on that, and he and I are going to sit down in the morning and try to figure that out. So would appreciate it if you'd give us a day or two to try to come to that conclusion.
I will do that. One caveat, right now you could file the UCC way, so by putting in the statute, we'd just be duplicating what you could already do, correct?
Well, Mr. Chairman, that's correct. Mark seems to think, Representative Simmons seems to think that although by putting the statute and making it clear that this is something that you should do, that his folks will better understand the process. I would agree with you that perhaps we can do that through education rather than putting something in the statute. That's one of the issues we're talking about.
Okay. Thank you. Any questions? I just one.
Thank you.
We close the public hearing on House Bill 2706. And do some others once we get them.
I think it's under 2352. None of the witnesses are here.
I don't see any of the witnesses.
Well, we can have the hearing.
I don't think that would serve the purpose.
Well, I can tell you what the bill does.
I know what a bill does. We'll wait. Could you call for my quorum? Senator Burdick was
down the hallway now.
She's down the hallway, all right.
No, she's not.
Yes.
Well, she don't want me.
No, we better do
that. I'll make her mind up.
You have the And subsection 2 allows components of corporations that may, upon a second stop where they can acquire conviction for certain offenses that are included, and other offenses are more motivated. Third, starting in line 19, shall be seized and forfeited the subject of forfeiture. It also, the DAS 12 amendments in the subsection 3 make it basically applicable to the citations and arrests and convictions after the effective date of the act. So it would require, before you have a vehicle forfeiture, require someone after the effective date of the act to have two convictions being arrested. on subsection 3.
Including a diversion in one of
those. That's right. Subsection 3 sets out a exemption to the National Act of City Attorney Ordinance enacted in 1999. And also on subsection 2, where the seizure corpus provision do not preempt a city with a population excessive. Exceeding $400,000, 400,000 people, excuse me, attaining the population exceeding 500,000 people, in making an ordinance. So they would be able to say, not the ordinance at that time, they could operate the ordinance independently of otherwise the election call.
How many people are in the city of Portland?
Mr. Chairman of the committee, I understand this in the fact 400,000.
Okay,
a population of 400,000, and that results in the achievement of 500,000.
Okay.
Because you can't do what you can't specifically name them.
That's right. That's what we're trying to give you a signal, Mr. Chair.
I understand now.
Let us get a record or otherwise. I was hoping you wouldn't. No, Mr. Chair?
Yes.
That's well, Bart.
Yeah.
The line 16 on page 2 says October 1, 1999. We change that to January 1, 2000 for the way to ring in the new year.
If we can.
Okay.
Senator Cardin moved it to central. We're going to have a conceptual amendment proposed by Senator Courtney on line 16 of the dash 12. On page 2, to change October 1st, 1999 to January 1, 2000. Is there an objection to that conceptual amendment? Hearing the order.
Mr.
Chairman, the committee, if the committee wants to change this to the shelf or later, it basically should move the new subsection 3. Otherwise, it doesn't make too much sense to have on the second one. It seems I'm off forfeiture would have been another. And then on the third one, on the subsection 2, there's just forfeiture to be made. So if you want to do that, what you should do is remove lines 19 to 24 on page 1, and then lines 1 to 6 on page 2, and then going down the lines 10. And moving out to the city, and 3, and 13, and 30.
So that would be another conceptual amendment that would have the effect of making it then discretionary.
That's correct, Mr. Chairman. For some reason, making something that the council doesn't want to be able to do that.
I
still
move to.
Mr.
Senator Courtney makes another conceptual amendment as outlined by Mr. Taylor, dealing with Section 3, deleting it from page 1, line 19 through 24. On page 2, then, line 1 through 8, and then on line...
It would be 1 through 6, not 7 and 8, because we still want to clarify the policy.
Right. So conceptual amendment will go on page 2 from line 1 to 6, and then in section 3 on page 2, leading specifically what, Mr. Taylor?
And number 3, and on line 10, after the 2, deleting and in parentheses 3, line 13, after the subsection 2, deleting and subsection 3.
Questions concerning the conceptual amendment, Senator Bruton?
What does that do again?
Chairman, the committee, when it basically does, as it relates to forfeitures, it makes the forfeitures not mandatory upon, no matter how many, whether it's the second, third, or fourth.
It'll allow the county and the city to make up their mind exactly
right.
What they want to do.
This is a civil action, Mr. Chairman, just means not criminal.
Is there discussion or objection to the amendment? Conceptual amendment? Hearing this, please.
Sure, I move the dash 12 amendments as amended and conceptual amendment to House Bill 3304.
And Courtney has moved House Bill 3304 as conceptually amended with the dash 12 amendments. Discussion? Objection? So what?
Sure, I move House Bill 3304 as amended before the due pass recommendation.
Thank you, Senator. Courtney has moved the bill as amended before due pass. Discussion? Objection? So ordered. Senator Courtney has offered to carry.
I got to carry this, so you're going to have to help me on the speech.
I will. I will. And I'm sure Mr. Taylor will help you too. Mr. Taylor, why don't we do HR 89 now if we're ready on the reconsideration order? Do we need an attorney to know here to
to complete the meeting.
Actually, we don't. I think I can find the amendment.
It'd be nice to have them here, but we would have. Do you have the amendment?
This is HDR 8-9. I have no amendment.
I just have the report.
Of 9 and 10.
And I think that trustee.
Mr. Chairman,
the person here will be fitted.
Right here. Oh, I do have them.
89-8,
day 11. Let me bring it back for the committee. The chair would move that we suspend the rule for possible reconsideration of HJR 89.
Discussion? Objection?
Sorry, the chair then would move that we reconsider our vote by which to send HJR 89 to the floor with the new pass recommendation.
Discussion?
Objection? We now have the bill before us with the new amendments. Mr. Taylor.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, the Dash 11 amendments that you have in front of you are the same, with the exception of line 7 that the Dash 10 that the committee adopted. So what that does is that at line 14 of the bill, where it says, class 35, and the certain date of person are required to report for jury duty, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. And this is because afterwards, when looking at the issue again, there was ambiguity here that the people who are on grand jury don't serve necessarily 15 years preceding the trial. The trial is the date of the committee. Grand jury is not necessary. We'll clarify that for the date of person required to report. There's been question as to whether the 15-year system, you know, that you're convicted of a felon within the last 15 years applies if it's a jury trial or whether it also applies to the civil under one year. I'm just trying to think. 15 years is huge.
And we have the 10s and the 11s?
The 10s is just so you can see what you adopted. The 11s are the same as the 10 except for the 7.
Thank you. Senator Dunn, the Dash 811 Amendment to HJR 89. Discussion? Objection? So ordered. Senator Duncan then moves HJR 89 as amended to the floor for DFAS recommendation. Discussion? Objection? Senator Burdick has us objecting, and I'm the carrier on these. I'll continue to carry. And Mr. Taylor, the question on HJR 93 has been resolved.
Chairman, that's correct. The Attorney General looked at the issue again and decided that
good. Let us then turn to
is it possible that they'll just get the order from here? Tell us what we have left. I'm confused. I've marked the line up and I have the third one and I'm just curious what we have left to do in this list.
On the agenda?
Mm-hmm.
I might be able to help.
Okay.
If you're looking at the revised agenda for today.
Right.
First one we have is HB 2396. Have we done this with Kevin? I don't think we have.
2390. I thought we did. Only one of the committee
that. Yes, we did. That one is done. 3158 we have done. So we brought that one back. 2229.
Chairman, we need to bring this back to motion because it's actually comparable to the amount of that.
Let's do that right now, and then we'll go through the rest of the agenda.
Okay.
We'll ask that the rule be suspended so that the committee can reconsider its vote on HB 2229. Discussion? Objection? Chair then would move that we reconsider our vote by which we sent this morning, HB 2229 to the floor to do pass recommendation. Discussion. Taylor, what are the conflicts?
These six amendments, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, you have before you are accomplished, and then you need to go for the point on the bill that goes to that.
Thank you. We will, Chair, then remove the B6 amendments to House Bill 2229. Discussion. Objection. Chair, then would move HB 2229.
629 as amended before due pass. Discussion, objection, ordered, same carrier. We did, turning the page on the agenda, we did 2349. we have not done 2352. We have had the public hearing on 2706. There's no work session scheduled. We have completed 2937. We have done the public hearing 3489. We've done the HCR 11. We've done the public hearing on HJR 21 at 3:30. The Attorney General and Secretary Keesling will come and testify. On 2226, that one we have not taken up yet.
Sure. So as a committee, we have this bill on for tomorrow. We're working on refining the language. So we'd be probably better to make it.
And we also have some concerns from Mr. Swank on the cost of how the money would be accounted for. On 2307, we have some proposed language change there. That one we'll probably take up tomorrow. Then 2353, we have not done. 3538, we won't be doing. No, that one, if we have the public hearing and there was objection to it, brought out some good points, and the opponent of the bill was going to try and work with people to find some solutions. 2383, we've handled. And 2462, we've done. And I think the rest are still before. Oh, yes, and we just did 3304. Right. On 3361, we're having some other amendments drafted. Okay.
Good.
And on which one, Ann?
3492.
Right, amendments are being drafted. That should be ready tomorrow. On turn the next page, 52 will do tomorrow, HR 52. And then we haven't done Senate Bill 841 or Senate Bill 1009. So that's where we are on.
I really appreciate that.
We've done a lot today over the last 8 hours. Representative Wood, I believe you're here on 3361, and there are some amendments being drafted that probably won't be ready till tomorrow. What those amendments do will include in the bill veterans benefits in addition to Social Security. And I think there's a different set though, because I just gave authorization to have a draft of it. So, yeah. And
Chairman of the committee, I believe it was Mr. Neville from
they
pointed out, for example, that it may cause a problem because it will allow the agency the ability to do something the courts would do. When they were talking with the attorneys for the support enforcement division, and we're working out some language with them, and they thought it would address some of the concerns, not all of them, to raise the unit amendment. They have conceptual language. We have to have the legislative council draft along for the added before the committee allows the state.
I also asked them to address the issue of when you could apply for this, going back to the people that where they're not supposed to have a modification hearing except every 2 years, and if you change the rule, you should be able to have a modification hearing sooner than that based upon that rule change or statute change. So they were also going to work on some language dealing with that. And then there was another issue that escapes me. But Representative Witt, when those amendments are ready, I'll make sure you get a copy. And I'll make sure you're notified of when the bill's going to be ready for hearing. But my hope is it'll be today or tomorrow.
Tomorrow, not today.
Not today.
Tomorrow or the next day.
Tomorrow the next day. Yes, Senator Beckett.
Representative, Mr. Vice President, Dennis, once he's in the table tomorrow, I hope he lives in the area, don't they?
So you can give your, if you have some testimony, you can present that today, but we're not going to move the bill today.
Okay, I'm fine to do that.
Before we do that, if I can have your patience just for a moment, we did have a scheduled hearing at 3:30 with Attorney General Hardy Myers and also Secretary of State Phil Keegan. So we'll do that first and then come to your testimony. So we will now go back to public testimony on SKR 21 and invite Hardy Myers and Phil Keegan. Chair Bryant, members of the committee, my name is Phil Kiesling, Secretary of State. We're here today to just briefly testify as requested and also be available for questions about SJR 21. And I'll just make a few brief comments and then turn it over to Attorney General Myers. This is a bill that we really, I think both of us would like to be able to support. It aims at a very real problem, what I call the overamending of the Oregon Constitution. 50% of all the constitutional amendments in the 1990s have been proposed constitutional amendments, proposed initiatives, many of which had no reason being constitutional amendments, turning our basic framework document into a corkboard with thumbtacks and post-it notes scattered hither and yon. I've made this speech to far more chambers of commerce, rotary clubs, land clubs, etc. than I care to count. It has been a long-standing concern of mine. This is one of literally dozens of ideas that I really like 90%. And then I take a deep breath and look at that last 10% and think through the implications. How would it really work in real life? What are the consequences seen and unforeseen? And I just have to take a deep breath and say, whoa. This is, and I applaud Senator Metzger for bringing this forward because it is one of the most basic, bedeviling problems that we face. But I think there are some very major concerns. This is far more sweeping a change than doing something like changing the signature spread. By the way, the last time the Oregon Constitution was amended in any significant fashion to deal with the initiative process was in 1968, dealing with changing the denominator for signatures from the Supreme Court race to the governor's race. A couple of things I just briefly mentioned about, and I have shared these concerns with Senator Metzger all along, and I am also want to let you know I'm very prepared and ready and eager to spend any time this committee directs us to explore this. I do have to say in candor and in some sadness that I'm not sure this particular approach aiming at the right targets can get us there. You may have to, in a sense, back out of this particular construct and go in a different direction if that's the goal. This would give the Secretary of State of Oregon a power that no other state has given the Secretary of State, and maybe neither here nor there, but I just want to point that out. It's going to be my successor because I'm term limited out. But it would also apply
unlike other tests of constitutional amendments, only to initiated constitutional amendments. It would not apply to referrals. Note the argument, for example, by H.R. 4, so-called DOMA bill. Proposed as a constitutional amendment initiative, be under this test. Arguably, you might say it's not needed, and therefore cannot be constitutional amendment. Legislature, of course, would not be if this bill is written under that. It also, so there's that issue. There are no specific standards as to exactly how you would do this analysis other than, and I'm not the attorney here, but I'd be faced with seeking the advice of the Attorney General's office and would give it. What are the standards by which you would decide that something could not be enacted unless it were a constitutional amendment? Well, you probably have to say that a given set of language is unconstitutional under the current Oregon Constitution, because that's how you would decide whether it should go forward as a constitutional amendment or be a statute. And if the question essentially is a given set of language constitutional under the Oregon Constitution, and that's how I understand this bill works, in effect, you're asking the Attorney General to give a definitive opinion at the front end of this process as to whether a given proposal violates the Oregon Constitution. It could be simply a recapitulation of existing language that's already in statute, changed perhaps, or maybe just given verbatim, but to ask that. And then, of course, the bill provides for judicial review. Other decisions that we make, is it a single subject, is it more than one amendment, are generally procedural issues, and also, by the way, are appealable up through the court system, Circuit Court, Court of Appeals, and the Supreme Court. This provides a direct route of access through the Dash 1 amendments to the Oregon Supreme Court, and in effect, the Oregon Supreme Court would then be asked, does it violate the Oregon Constitution as written? These are not necessarily insurmountable issues, but they are profoundly important issues. They speak to the heart of the separation of powers. They speak to issues about how we legislate in Oregon, which is split in two. It's through the initiative process. It's through the legislative process. And many of us who have been very uncomfortable with how the initiative played out and has advocated many things and indeed been vilified by many of the people who, interestingly enough, I suddenly find myself allied with expressing some concerns about this bill. We wrestle with these things because they are very, very big issues. They speak to longstanding legal theories. The guarantee clause was mentioned, an issue that has come before the courts for much of the last century. But I want to just share with the committee those concerns, as I shared, my staff did, with the Senate Rules Committee, where this bill was before. I apologize, Senator Metzger, and to you, because perhaps we didn't more actively work these and have some of these meetings ahead of time to see what might be done. But I not only can't support the bill in the current form, I must regretfully oppose it, because I believe that as outstanding and as good a target as is being aimed at, I don't think this approach can hit it without causing problems that, in a sense, may even go beyond the benefits that we have. So with that, I'll turn it over to Attorney General Myers to have a couple other observations, and then we'll be happy to answer any of your questions.
Thank you, Mr. Bryant. Members, for the record, I'm heard about as Attorney General. First, I'd like to very much associate myself with the objective of the measure, which is to address the problem of the use of the initiative process to put ordinary statutory material into the Oregon Constitution. I vice-chaired a pretty close committee which studied the initiative referendum in Oregon and reported in 1996, and the first of the major trends that it noted with the initiative in Oregon was indeed that very trend, which was to increasingly use the initiative to convert statutory type matter into constitutional amendments so as to preclude legislative review of them and modification of them, and to preclude the Supreme Court review of them for consistency with the Oregon Constitution. There are two problems, as I see it, with the proposal as to how to get at that problem, and I want to take just a couple of minutes to describe what I think they are. First of all, the test that is set forth here to determine what can and cannot qualify as a constitutional amendment is framed in terms of basically whether or not the proposal would violate a provision of the existing Constitution. Or to put it a different way, would the proposal be one that collides in some way with some current provision of the American Constitution, or does it fall in effect between or among existing provisions? Now, that is not going to be an easy standard to administer, I think, legally. It's going to mean that we've got to analyze all the provisions of the Constitution in relation to the measure. We've got to the extent there's any uncertainty about the meaning of a current provision, we've got to try to correctly prophesy what a court would decide as to whether, in fact, the meaning intersects with some provision of the proposed new measure. It's going to be extremely difficult to administer. But the second concern, and maybe this goes more into a policy issue that I wanted to mention, is that this particular form of test basically freezes into place, it makes the test basically a test of what's in the Constitution now. Now, that becomes the standard against which the proposal is judged, not the substance of the proposal itself. And that means that there could be some very, very appropriate kinds of constitutional amendments that would be precluded because they could be dealt with statutorily. For example, a proposal to create an office of lieutenant governor, putting aside merits, is one that I think very appropriately could be viewed as a proper addition to the Oregon Constitution. We put one or two of our current offices in the Constitution.
And I agree here on this.
That's right. Mm-hmm. I'm going to say Kiesling, the governor, I believe the state treasurer, at least those three.
And the superintendent.
Yes, I believe that's right as well. In any event, I don't think there's anything inconsistent with the basic nature of a constitution to put elements of the state governmental structure into it, if that's the wish of proponents and the people. But that would be, for example, excluded by this test. The Rights Amendment, you could probably come up with dozens of examples of possible proposals which could appropriately be in a constitution that would be excluded.
Of course, the legislature could still do referral under this proposal to make constitutional changes.
Yes. Yep.
But I see your point.
And as an outgrowth of the City Club study, the way the court recommends that this issue be addressed is to attempt to propose to the people that we limit constitutional amendments to amendments that address certain described subject matters. And I'll give you quick examples from prior work that was done either in connection with the club's report or subsequently. The structure and organization of government, the election of officials, the allocation of governmental powers. In other words, the tests are stated as positive descriptions of the substance of the proposal, regardless of whether they could be enacted as statutes. And the judgment of whether they can be proposed as constitutional amendments doesn't hinge on trying to interpret what current provisions of the Constitution mean. They hinge on what it is the proposal proposes to do. It's very different and much, I think, easier to administer. So it's really from those two standpoints, Chilbright members, that I would, as I've discussed with Senator Nesko, I would encourage that the problem, which I think is a very real problem, a very important problem, we invite the people of Oregon to consider that it be approached from a different direction, so that a different solution be proposed for the people to consider.
Thank you.
Senator Riddick.
Yeah, that obviously raises the question of what would make a reasonable solution. We have the bill to increase the percentage of signatures to 12%, which is one approach. But do you see any other ways of accomplishing this particular thing of, you know, saving the Constitution out for the really constitutional issues and diverting the other things into statute?
Well, Senator Burdick, members of the committee, I think the issue of raising the signature for the Constitution, which I fully support, is a separate issue. The two are not at all mutually exclusive. One just very, it's much simpler, straightforward. It says, you know, X number of signatures. It's pursuing the City Club issue about affirmatively saying what should be in a constitution and not, the issue of constitutional appropriateness. I share Attorney General Myers' belief that that is a more easily administered standard from the standpoint of my office, and ultimately more so KIT, because just understand the relationship. I ultimately, as Secretary of State, has to ultimately certify if it complies with various requirements, including any new ones. But we rely on Attorney General advice, and that, of course, is subject to public record law, so there's a record about all of that laid out. I think this body would have to wrestle with not only the policy issue of exactly how you write that language and think about what is then included and what isn't included and how does it apply to existing constitutional provisions and how do you deal with changing amendments that are already there that don't fall into that category but now we want to amend it or even repeal it and deal with that kind of issue. And I think you have another very important issue to deal with, which is whether you want to have a separate standard for initiated constitutional amendments versus legislative. And it's just a cautionary note, and it is a political question, ultimately, more than a legal question. But the question is, of something like the initial process, you ultimately have to get 50% plus one of Oregonians to agree to change. And I think that you have to just be cognizant of making the argument that we believe that you, the citizens of Oregon, should not have certain powers to amend your constitution and certain abilities, but that we wish to reserve to the legislature. Now, we have done that. You can revise the constitution as legislators or propose a revision of it. And you can't do that through the initiative process. That's the one exception. Three quarters of you have to agree to that, and then you can send it out, and a majority vote will revise it. But that is a significant issue as well. But that's less a legal issue than it is a political question. But the two are not mutually exclusive at all. You can proceed down both tracks if you so choose.
Shavar, Senator Burdick, I think the only other way than to try to describe in the Constitution what types of measures in terms of subject can be constitutional amendments. I think the only other way you might theoretically get at the problem is this, and bear with me to explain. When Oregon adopted the initiative in the early 1900s, a challenge was raised against it judicially based on a asserted violation of the so-called Republican form of government clause of the U.S. Constitution, which basically is a guarantee of representative lawmaking. That is, that's the key element of Republican form of government as defined in the U.S. Constitution. And the Supreme Court of Oregon rejected that challenge on the basis that the legislature could always amend an initiated measure. So the legislature wasn't being displaced. Now, if and to the extent a measure is not truly appropriate or a constitutional measure, whatever standard that applies, and is instead ordinary statute and being put into the Constitution to do just that, to prevent the legislature from changing it, an argument could arise that is a violation of the Republican form of government clause. Now, ahead of ever getting to that issue, you've got the fact that right now the Supreme Court of Oregon is saying that that's not an issue it will review, that is violation of that clause. It's basing its interpretation on federal decisions dealing with federal court review. And so that's a long-range possibility that might someday gain life as a way of questioning use of the initiative process to put statutory material in the Constitution. But short of that, very on a sort of hypothetical possibility. I think the only way you can get at it is to invite the people to narrow access to proposing constitutional amendments by describing some test that they have to pass in order to qualify.
The report of the City Club, I remember reading it, it was came out before the 97 session, and came to some conclusions and made some recommendations. And, in the Armada decision, was the issue of a Republican form of government, was it briefed? Was that in somehow raised? I know they didn't get to it because they decided the case based upon the single issue.
Chair Bryan, I also did not remember.
It was not? Okay.
David, has it ever been
briefed
before the court? What case was that that was briefed on?
Mr. Chair, for the record, David Sedanke, ACLU of Oregon. The Republican form of government guarantee has been briefed in a number of cases before the Oregon Supreme Court, and I don't remember the case citation that the Attorney General was referring to, but that is the most recent, which is that the Oregon Supreme Court said that we're not going to attempt to enforce that guarantee to judicial power in Oregon because of the position the federal court has taken. The principle is still there, it's just unenforceable.
Well, you know, what the United States Supreme Court, the federal courts have addressed is the question of whether that issue is reviewable in federal courts. They have not actually addressed the issue in terms of state court review. I think our state court is extrapolating their ruling as to justiciability in state court from these holdings dealing with federal court review.
And there is.
But the Supreme Court has not yet, the United States Supreme Court has not yet squarely said that a state court may not review compliance of its governmental institutions with the Republican form of government.
And Mr. Chair, just to add, there is a fair amount of disagreement over that issue among legal scholars.
And as a non-legal scholar, Mr. Chair, I might add that there are, obviously, that issue could at some point in the future just be dealt with judicially, just as the Armada decision was. Also, do not note, and this doesn't speak directly to legislation, but there's been an effort the last two election cycles for some former law school deans who have shared this concern about the overmanning of the Constitution, has at their own volition and encouragement of many, including myself, banded together to actually look at proposed initiatives and have raised money to put in the voter stamp of statements and include whether they believe in their judgment that something is constitutionally appropriate or not. That, of course, is not any kind of formal structure. It is just part of the record. But I do think it has helped Oregonians as they evaluate whether to vote yes or no. I think the question is being asked at some level by people.
Other questions? Thank you for your
thank you.
Well, then, hearing on SJR 21 and open session on Bill 361. And good afternoon.
Mr. Chair, Senators, Representative has to leave and go to a conference, and he's just letting you know my attempt. I believe we have some handouts given up there. You were saying that there were some amendments coming up about the Veterans Administration. If I remember from the last hearing, the Department of Human Resources didn't want to include veterans benefits than they do now. The Department of Human Resources during the last session, if I remember correctly, did not want to include veterans benefits, but they do now.
Well, what they're willing to do is accept them as a change of circumstance in modification of the
agree that they should be considered by the court. As well as the fact that you try to test it down. There's still objection with the issue.
All right, so I think the study that I have done, I have checked all the states on the West Coast, and we are the only one that does not recognize a dollar for dollar study. And I believe that I passed that out on one of the things that the heading on it was Subject Washington. I have just highlighted each state, and then I've highlighted where they went ahead and specifically in there stated the, not in the word dollar for dollar, but it's in essence the same thing as dollar for dollar. We'll take Washington, for example. When Social Security Administration pays Social Security disability dependency benefits, retirement benefits, or survivor insurance benefits on behalf or on account of the child or children of a disabled person, a retired person, or a deceased person, the amount of benefits paid for the child or children shall be treated for all purposes as if the disabled person, the retired person, or the deceased person paid the benefits towards the satisfaction of the person's child support obligation. And each one of the states on the West Coast here, I've got Washington, California, Idaho, Arizona, without looking at them here, all say the same thing, but in different wording. Ours is a little bit different for us. It says dollar for dollar. The only reason I picked out Colorado as an example for the West Coast is the Department of Human Resources, when they did their child support guidelines, they had an outfit from Denver, Colorado, do the study. So I went to the Colorado statutes, and they go ahead and state the same thing. They have recognized a dollar for dollar credit. And then when I did read the study that was done to propose these guidelines that we are currently using here in Oregon today, which was quite extensive, they only mentioned one other state, and that was the state of Vermont. Actually, they mentioned two states, Oregon and Vermont. And that's the reason I picked Colorado as an example. They claim in their thing, the way we do it here and the way they did it in Vermont, separating the two incomes and figuring them the way we do, it is actually inflating the child support amount, and it's unfair. And I believe that was in one of my other handouts that I had passed out. And that was the appendix from 115 and 116, and that was from the study. And I didn't think you wanted another 150-page report up there, so that's why I just picked out that one excerpt. And that's basically the unfairness of the way we figure it here and the way they did it in Vermont. And I thought that this was a pretty simple bill, and all we're here doing is looking for the disabled people to get credit for what's being paid on their behalf. I didn't want to go into this, but a couple things happened to me in the last week, and I didn't want to go into my disabilities, but I did want to cover it. It's only going to take a couple minutes. I worked for over 30-some years before I broke my back the first time. And I paid into this Social Security as an insurance thing, and that's why these benefits are paid on my behalf. If I do become disabled, they will take care of my children for me. And those benefits should be credited to me and not given to my ex-wife. That's free money, and I get zero credit for it. And the other thing that had to happen to me is I was told not to do it. I'm a Vietnam veteran, and I watched this movie called Private Ryan. And at the end, there was one statement that says to Private Ryan, he says, earn what you got. And the Private Ryan did get with his life and come back to the States. There's a lot of people that died in the war over there, and a lot of people injured. I myself was wounded 4 times. Caught malaria over there, Agent Orange. I guess I kind of walk around here like I don't have disabilities. I'm very proud, and I don't want people to know that I have disabilities. but my back has been broken 5 times. The Agent Orange is destroying my insides. My bones are all deteriorating. And in a couple of years, I probably will not be walking. My nerves are being eaten away on the inside. To be disabled, you don't have to have a missing arm or missing leg. We have very serious disabilities, and I want those to be recognized. Most of these were gained as a veteran. And this is not what I went off to the war for and fight 30 years ago. I went off there believing in my country and then coming back here. They gave me benefits because I was disabled, and I would like to have those benefits recognized. When my country asked me to go, I was there. I mean, more so than some others, I was a highly decorated veteran. I had 21 personal decorations. When my country asked me to do something, I did it. Now they're giving me benefits, and living here in Oregon, I'm being denied those benefits that were given to me to pay for my children.
In your particular case, you probably had hearings before dealing with child support. Did the judge give you any credit?
Zero, sir.
So he didn't take that into consideration in any way as far as the amount of child support that he ordered?
Mr. Chair, I thank you for asking for that. I almost did forget to address that. In our amendment, we have the A2 amendment here, and I believe it's on line 11, page 4, line 1. Delete the word may and insert the word shall. Okay, these guidelines that Oregon is currently using, well, we're told, came into effect this year, March of this year, and they said we do recognize Social Security benefits to some degree. I disagree with the way they're doing it because it gives her credit for her disability as it does as well as it does me. But even so, I should have been given credit for those disability payments because I had a hearing after these guidelines came into effect. And the only bad thing was it says they may consider these disability benefits, and they chose not to. After the courts chose not to, I wrote to the Department of Human Resources asking for a review using the new guidelines. Again, it says they may use it. They also chose not to give me credit. That's why we say they shall give us credit for these, or heck, we shall consider them, these benefits.
Senator Cardin,
how are you, sir?
Senator Courtney, Mr. Bryant, my children are 15 and 12. I have one other child from a previous marriage. She's 22 years old.
Have you had a lawyer in these discussions with the judge on your amount of child support and things like that? Have you ever been a lawyer?
Kind of semi-quasi. They wouldn't let me do the research and represent me in the court. But I did most of the research because I didn't have the money to pay them the full amount of attorney for the lotted.
But you're a lawyer presenting your side of the case, is that correct?
Yes, Senator Courtney, I did. And this particular last case here, I have this particular attorney is in front of the state bar right now to answer for not defending me the way he should have in this last hearing.
Is that because of you?
No. This is the thing that he did. There was a little collusion. After the hearing was completely over, the other side wanted to go ahead and submit testimony and evidence that was never brought up or discussed during the trial, and he gave them permission to send this in without asking me, and what he did send in was untrue, but my attorney approved it without my approval or even checking with me. And that's what their court order was based upon.
Child support payments now, is that correct?
Yes, I chose almost 8 or 9 years ago now to have those taken out of my disability payments.
Well, so you be allotted. Behind, are you in arrears at all?
I'm in arrears of $5,000. I was in arrears from day one. My ex-wife has been receiving child support benefits since 1986 on my behalf. They went for her automatically from 1986, even when we were together. And when I became separated, they still go to her, and I've never gotten credit. Our divorce started in 1989. We were only married for 4 years. But she has always received those benefits, and I've never gotten credit for one penny of it.
So, is this for the former marriage, or this is for these two children? I'm just here. Are you the arrears of any, in terms of the former child, the child you had by the former marriage at all, or is there any issue there at all in terms of child support or anything?
Senator Brian, Mr. Courtney, no, there is not.
Well, 15, 12-year-old that we're talking about in terms of the arrears and the problems with the lawyer and things like that. Everything's there, is that right?
That's correct. And the reason, the other thing about the veterans' benefits, now when these children turn 18, and this is where it comes into play with the 22-year-old, after the children turn 18, Social Security benefits will stop. But because I am 100% disabled through the Veterans Administration, they will take the $180 for each child out of my disability payments. But they will also pay to the child $400 a month for them to go to school. And those would be benefits we'd like to be considered.
How long have you been a host of disabled veterans to veterans?
6 years. I started out at 30%, and slowly as the age norm started deteriorating, my body and the bones started breaking. It percentage.
You come out of NAM, directly out of NAM, and we're 100% disabled.
Not out of, for the first 6 months, they had me in a Heinz hospital for combat disease.
In terms of your wounds, you said you were wounded for it, but there's no disability. Disability started when? Some degree of disability in terms of the official designation started when, please?
For the veterans,
1976. Now, 6 years ago, there was some degree of disability prior to that time, too, in terms of being officially recognized as being disabled, 30% or something, anything like that, or is it just...
Okay, actually, 1976 when my veterans... disability started. They offered it to me right out of Vietnam, but I declined. They offered me a 20% disability at a discharge at that time, and I declined.
All right. Thank you very much, Mr. Chair, for indulging me.
No problem. Any questions?
Yes. Okay. I have a question. What if you were living in California right now, what would be different? Or Idaho?
If I was living in either one of these states, I would get credit for the back child support that has been paid on my behalf and these benefits that my children are receiving that I would get credit for. But being in Oregon here...
What does that
mean? Answer the question.
Part of my credit, you mean dollar for dollar credit?
Dollar for dollar credit, yes. Senator Biden, Mr. Dunn. I would receive full credit for all of the payments that are made on my behalf for my children. Then they go directly to the representative payee, which is my ex-wife. The way the checks come out from Social Security, they go to whoever the representative payee is for each child, my disability payments. And in my case, my disability payment from the Social Security is $588 a month.
Okay, just assuming you had no children right now, what would be happening? If you had no children...
Then there would be no payments made on my behalf. I would receive a disability for myself only.
And do you get that now?
I do, and that's being garnished at 60%. And the Department of Human Resources, they just requested 89% garnished for my disability payments.
Okay, so let's assume it's $1,000. I'm an indication. Okay.
Okay. Yes, sir.
And then you also have, because you have children, is there additional payments they make that goes directly to your ex-wife for the children? Or does it all come out of that $1,000? I'm just using the $1,000 figure because I'm not trying to.
Okay, Senator Bryan, Mr. Senator Duncan, that is a good question. It took me a long time to figure out the benefits, too, and how it does work. If I am disabled, then you're right, let's use $1,000 as an example. The way Social Security does is they look at all the years that you've worked, And that would put me at the level of, okay, he worked his extra amount a year.
Excuse me, just a second. Yeah, explain. Okay, we have two things. We have the veterans benefits and the Social Security, right?
Yes, sir, you know.
Social Security, Senator Goder.
Okay.
Okay. Now, the $1,000 we talked about originally, that was veterans?
$1,000 would be for Social Security.
Oh, okay. Social Security.
And the way Social Security does it, if my benefit, monthly benefit is $1,000 a month, they divide that in half. So my children receive $500, regardless if I have 10 children or one child. That's all I get, is half of what I earn goes to my children for support. But once the children become 18, or if I have no children, that benefit is not there. It's just only if we have children.
Children, okay, so it's a 500, I've got that. And that's Social Security. Where does the 60% come into play?
Of what they're requesting. And they've gotten, I don't know how they did it, but they're getting the 60%.
They're probably receiving that because of your delinquency. That they can then request an additional amount if you're delinquent.
Okay.
Well, then you have a $4,000 or $5,000 delinquency. They can request an additional amount to cover that delinquency.
And the reason that delinquency came apart at the very beginning, and my ex-wife's attorney and my attorney, which was Kim O'Neill at the time, had agreed, okay, she is receiving benefits upon your behalf, and you will get credit for those when the child support award comes out. And that's the only thing that generated an arrearage in the very beginning. And they chose not to give me a credit for those benefits being paid. And that's where the only place the arrearage has come from.
The reason why they're asking, I imagine, for the additional.
Right. Now, that's another question, if I could. Where does Social Security, where do your veterans benefits come into play now?
Right now, at this point, the veterans benefits by this state are not being recognized. My daughter.
What are they? He's asking the dollar amount.
$180.
Fictitious figure. I don't. Not quite.
Okay. In my case, it's $180 per child.
And that's strictly for children only. I mean, you don't get any benefits for yourself.
It goes to either me or to the ex-whoever we allot it to. In the case of my daughter going to school, it goes directly to her.
He also receives a direct benefit.
Correct, I receive a direct benefit.
So,
on my own.
So let's assume could that be, let's say, $1,000 or something like
that? We could use $1,000 again.
Yeah.
It is actually $2,000. We could use, that is what I get.
Yeah, but I'm just trying to play. Okay, so then you have, the way I look at using our current figures, you currently get to keep $1,500 less the pickups they're picking up on the arrearage. And then your children are getting the $500 split and $180 each from veterans, right?
$400 at this present time.
Set up.
Why are they getting $400?
But my daughter in college is. Right now there's no allotment going to her. It is not being recognized by 15-year-old and my 12-year-old. My 22-year-old is receiving these $400, and they're docking my pay $180, and he gets $400, and that covers the support for a child attending school.
See, while they're in school, in college, or anytime in school, in college.
They have to be attending college until they are 20. They can do this up until they're 26 years.
26.
26.
And that's exactly what goes against your money.
It is counted in Wisconsin as being counted as covering my child support award. It covers my child support obligation.
Are you getting it so you know what the difference between here and Washington is?
I think so. In Oregon, it's discretionary to the judge how much credit they want to allow for those things. Currently in Oregon, on an issue of child support or spousal support, there's a formula that's used in this.
put in the money, you put in the expenses, and you divide it up. And there is not a mandatory rule that there has to be a dollar-for-dollar credit for the for these type things.
Are we being fair?
Are we being fair? I don't know. That's a good question. This is the first time this has come up in my 4 years on judiciary. We've got dozens of support issues. This is the first time this has come up. In my experience, when I used to try these cases, when this issue was up, it was part of the mix that the judge considered when he made a decision on support. So I never had a question where our court said, I'm not going to consider this amount of money that's paid directly to the spouse or to the child. They always made a consideration for it. Now, was it a dollar-for-dollar offset? I can't tell you it was, but it was a reasonable consideration for it.
But the next thing I'd ask you, Chair, is this just possibly an unfair judge? Is this something that legislative correction is needed to look at?
It's a good question, and the judge involved, Judge West, is very high to thought. We've had him testify in front of this committee before. I know he's testifying for the rules, so he's well thought of. Well, committee, if there are other questions worth asking, we need to get one of the bill today before we adjourn. So are there any other questions for the women?
Just one question. So what is the court order? Child support court order. Senator Bryant, Senator Courtney, right now my court order is $841 a month.
For the 12 and 15 year olds.
For the two children. And if these guidelines were adhered to, I should be, and I was allowed credit for my disability payments from Social Security, I would only be paying $38 a month. In this case, Judge West did not look at the guidelines whatsoever. How was
Judge Greg West?
Correct. I don't know how, I do not know how he came up with this order. There was another, if I may, Senator, pardon you, Senator Bryant. The way the guidelines here read, and I believe this is the question you were asking, Senator Duncan, they take, according to our guidelines, they, with this new ruling that they said they allow Social Security benefits this year, they say that to figure child support, we have to take each person's income and add them together, which I agree with, and say this would be your total amount that comes into the household. And then they want to take my disability award and add that on, which also gives her credit for the disability and not me. So she's getting partial credit for my disability, and it shouldn't be that way.
Senator Duncan has one other question.
Mr. Chair, one quick question. And I feel like I'm getting into your personal business, but Chair, that helps us. You can refuse to answer. My question is, at that time, do you have personal assets for property or other aspects that the judge took into consideration?
Mr. Bryant, Senator Duncan, I believe that was a good question. I think you guys are probably referring to some of the testimony from the last hearing, and that was an incorrect statement. I think there was a claim that I had a home, and I filed bankruptcy, and I got that home. This is absolutely untrue. I owned nothing. She got the home. She has everything. I have no personal property. The suit I'm wearing, it took me 4 years to save the money to buy it. I have no personal assets. And people were led to believe different the last time. That was very untrue. I have nothing.
I forgot that.
I thank you for asking, Senator Duncan.
We will now close the public work session on 3361. We'll probably revisit this tomorrow. And I'd like to go back to the public hearing, also 2352, invite Dale Penn and David Sedanke. Earlier, David Clinton was here, also on Jeff Meyer and Jeff.
Jeff Brown,
the governor's office. We'll invite them back. It's hard to judge when this is coming. Gentlemen, good afternoon.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Dale Penn. I'm representing the District Attorney Association.
I would simply say that page 2 of this measure is part of the measure that really gives the information that would be recommended to be provided to voters. The District Attorney Association does support the HJR's Crime Victims' Rights Amendments, and this measure was simply designed to answer the question that voters would have. I thought I already voted on this measure. Why is it back again? And the advice that is provided in House Bill 2352, I believe, is a neutral statement of the history of each of these measures, and that's what it was designed to do. Because of that, we think it would be helpful for the voter to understand why it is being presented to them a second time, and it doesn't take a position one way or the other, doesn't advocate one way or the other, but that's the reason for the bill. Because of that, we would support that.
Senator Cardi.
Mr. Attorney, we need to pass these legislation to describe why they're voting it again. There couldn't be a statement appear in the voter's pamphlet explaining it.
Well, Mr. Chair and Senator Courtney, I didn't propose this measure.
No, I'm not.
Yeah, and
I'm looking for a reason to indict me for something, because I'm always convinced that you're out looking to do that to me, because I live in North Salem. So don't get ticked at me. You understand, Dan? Plus, you owe me, but just turn around and check on your couple bills. Okay, you didn't propose this, so your answer is probably you don't need a bill, do you?
No. I simply said that I didn't propose this because I agree there are a variety of different ways that information can be provided to the voters. This is simply an additional manner. I believe it's an accurate, neutral statement, and that's on page 2. It's just to explain this is why we're here. You're right, it could be done by advertisements in the voter's pamphlet. If someone doesn't read the voter's pamphlet, however, they wouldn't see that. And so this would be something that would be on the ballot. But that's
right. I was on two committee last year, 2 years ago, about 1955, which failed, which was the prepaid tuition ballot measure that we passed out last year, in which we got together to come up with wording for different, one was the argument for, and one was a neutral ballot statement. Mr. Chair, you understand what I'm saying? And I don't quite understand, given that role I played in that ballot measure, why that wouldn't also come forward and be played by certain appointed legislators in these ballot measures. And they could include a neutral statement, as you refer. I don't quite understand.
Well, Mr. Chair and Senator Courtney, I'm just trying to provide some of the reason for this bill, and I would expect that another answer to that question is that the legislature may decide that they want to make clear, or that you want to make clear, why this is back again. So that's the answer to the question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, David Stanky, Executive Director of ACLU of Oregon. We strongly oppose House Bill 2352. We believe it is an inappropriate special treatment being given to the proponents of these measures. There is no precedent for a bill like this as far as we are aware. There have been numerous initiatives that have been overturned by the courts because of constitutional defects. In essence, we believe that this bill is nothing more than an attempt to save the proponents of these measures from running a campaign. That in essence, you'd be giving a message to the voters that these measures are back before you because of the crazy judges that overturned Measure 40. You don't even need to bother reading these measures or paying any attention to what they do. Just vote yes. That's the message I get out of the special treatment that would be given these proposals. If this legislature chooses to save the proponents of Measure 40 $2 million by placing 8 different measures on the ballot without them having to go out and collect signatures, to put them on the ballot. We think it would be even more egregious to give them another $1 million from having to run a campaign. And so we strongly oppose language, which we believe is not neutral.
We would love to see, yeah, we would love to see Mr. Pedanke's interpretation as a dash six amendment.
Any questions? Thank you for your testimony.
Thank you.
I hope you know he's a very sick man if he just did that.
He's recovering. He's getting stronger.
Negotiating the ballot.
Committee, thank you for your help. We're adjourned today, and we got through a lot of stuff. I think tomorrow is going to be
a good. Hey, Dave, how's Tampa doing?